Regional Parliament, Friday, 26th of February 2016. And continue with answers to oral questions. We start at question number 160. Questioner is the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Services confirm how many people underwent a programme of drug rehabilitation in each year from 1996 to 2011? What I would say, Mr. Speaker, is that there is an error, that's my mistake, insofar as 1996 is concerned. What I would like the answer to is from 1999 rather than 1996. I apologise for that. If the Honourable Minister would answer the question in respect of that period, I would like it.
Given the distance from the Honourable Member and myself, I'd be grateful if you can raise your voice a bit. Okay? Thank you.
Repeat the question. Can the Minister for Social Services confirm how many people underwent a programme of drug rehabilitation treatment in each year from 1996 to 2011?
I am the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality and Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, the Government has not answered the Reform Act prior to the 8th of December 2011, and the Commission is appealing going back 20 years as requested originally, in 5 working days, giving any event a free certificate. Since January 2012, 56 people have completed treatment.
Mr. Speaker, just probably two supplementary questions in relation to that point. Mr. Speaker, you recall yesterday that I referred the Honourable Lady to a statement that she made in answer to a question that I put to her yesterday in relation to the statistics that she claimed that she had looked at on entering office. And she said, and I quote, "And then the answer when I looked at the statistics was clear. There was no one, Mr. Speaker. In the days of the two of you, Mr. Speaker, we were paying for rehab facilities, which was empty, Mr. Speaker. At the time, there had been one person undergoing treatment, at most two. Mr. Speaker, in answer to a question, number 574 in 2001, there were over 310 admissions to Bruton Farm from the years 2003 to 2010. And the Honourable the Minister has confirmed there were 56. Admissions at Bruce's Farm undergoing treatment. Can the Minister now confirm that the position that she stated in this house is incorrect and ask her to correct the record?
Thank you, Speaker. The statement is so preposterous that I actually don't know where to start. And I have to confess how sad it is that people are trying to score political points when it comes to rehabilitation. First and foremost, Mr. Speaker, yesterday you did make quite clear that we would not be answerable for any act before we came into government in December 2011, and notwithstanding the direction, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman continues to ask the statistics from 1999. So, Mr. Speaker, everything that was said yesterday fell on deaf ears.
A point of order, what is it? Mr. Speaker, on a point of order, and it is important, and I'd ask Mr. Speaker to reflect upon it, and if necessary, not rule now, but rule after Mr. Speaker has had some thought in relation to the matter. I said yesterday that constitutionally it cannot be the position that a government is only obliged to answer questions in relation to their term in office, because there may well be certain circumstances where it is justified to ask questions of the period prior, and that constitutionally a government is a continuous entity. Now, of course, it's always going to be in the discretion of a speaker as to whether a speaker allows those types of questions or doesn't allow those types of questions, because I can envision. But of course, Mr. Speaker can say, well, look, you know, they weren't in office at that time, and also it's oppressive to be asking something going back 20 years, because statistically, it really, the mass of statistics that produces, it is not fair on the machinery of government, or it's impossible, or a number of other reasons, but it just, it's the principle and the precedent that is being set of saying we cannot be responsible for any answer prior to December 2011, which I don't believe it is right. And I think the Honourable the Chief Minister, in fairness to him yesterday, has accepted that cannot be right as a across-the-board statement. And therefore, I would ask Mr. Speaker, even if he doesn't do it now, and allows the Honourable Lady to continue, that he thinks about it and then rules in due course.
Mr. Speaker, I can assist in this respect. But let's be very clear. It is impossible for us to be responsible for matters which relate to the period before we were in office. And responsibility is the key word here. If somebody wants data about something that relates to the period before we were in office, and it is readily available, then of course it is provided. And there'll be no difficulty with that. But in this instance, I think we have acknowledged yesterday, with 5 working days to prepare answers, it is impossible to produce 20 years of data, unless it is already data that is maintained and easily accessible. And we speak up very often, because something has been asked for in this house, the data is maintained in a particular way, and then you can literally pull it off the shelf when somebody asks for it to be updated, because the civil servants will diligently be keeping the data in the form that it's regularly asked for. But I certainly do not accept, and maybe the Honourable Gentleman did not mean to say this, I certainly do not accept that we have responsibility in respect of anything which relates to the period before the 9th of December 2011. But we will certainly always try to assist in providing information which relates to any period, because the Honourable Gentleman said that there is one government of Gibraltar, and there are different administrations. That, of course, is the correct position. There is a different government of Gibraltar after every new constitution. So there was one from 1969 and one from 2006. It doesn't really make any difference to the point I am making. And that's why yesterday, Mr. Speaker, what I also told the younger members they could do is write to the Chief Secretary if they wish to have information about periods when they were in office, and in some instances, I know that there are only 2 of them here who were in office, and they may have to pray and aid the assistance of some of our colleagues who were in office before. If they want a piece of data which relates to their ministerial responsibilities at the time between 1996 and 2011, we'll always try to help with data where available, but we will be responsible, of course, in respect of matters that relate before our election in total.
Can I come back in relation to that? We're both singing from the same hymn sheet. I stood up yesterday and I said and acknowledged that in relation to a question where one is asking statistical information going back 20 years, there may be all sorts of reasons why the government may say, well, look, we cannot answer that question, which is the point that the Honourable the Chief Minister is making. My point is a different one. What I don't want is the precedent being established that a government refuses to answer questions just simply based on the fact that that question relates to information prior to them coming into office in December 2011 in this instance. And I don't think there is a difference between my learned and an honourable friend, the Chief Minister, and myself in relation to this. But of course, because the Honourable Lady has answered the question in the way that she's answered it, I feel obliged to stand up so that there is no question established that we cannot ask any questions that may be appropriate, proportional, and reasonable as the information that arises prior to them taking office on December 2011. Member mentions the constitutional principle continuity of a government. And that is, of course, true as a constitutional principle. But there is a difference between continuity of government and continuity of information across different governments. And there is a rule that there are some files that a government doesn't have access to in relation to the previous administration. So many files, where once a government and administration come to an end, the files are put away in boxes,
and it is the civil servant and the chief secretary in particular that have access to those files. Now, if information is sought of this government in respect of a previous administration, we don't have access to those files to either contrast or compare or put data in its proper context. And therefore, coming to government, to Parliament, and being responsible for the information we give this Parliament, we cannot take that responsibility in respect of files that we don't have access to. And therefore, it creates a big, big practical difficulty for the government. And secondly, in terms of the standing orders that talk about giving information for which the government is responsible, we are not responsible for that information, particularly because in many cases we don't have access to that information and therefore cannot put even data in its proper context. I'm happy to give way.
But of course, the administration, as a chief minister, the chief secretary would have access, and he is the one who provides the continuity for whenever there is a change of government.
Absolutely, that is exactly. That is precisely constitutionally what is the position. And indeed, I recognize what the Honourable Minister for Justice is saying. I mean, there are files that are not disclosable. So, for example, a summary to the incumbent chief minister because it relates to something that happened prior to his coming into office, and there are particular types of files. I think it's the D files. I can't. It's a D file. Yes. There's a magic number by sequence. It's absolutely right. And therefore, I accept that. I accept that entirely. And that's why I come here and I said that it's quite reasonable for a government, under certain circumstances, for a variety of reasons, to refuse to answer a particular question when it is posed. But with respect to the Honourable Gentleman, when the standing orders talk about for which the government is responsible, you cannot just simply hermetically seal that or narrow it down the scope to government as at the point in time when they're in office, because there may well be information for which they are responsible, but that information came to light and came into being, probably the latter better than the former way of characterizing it, prior to them coming into office. And I think that we all see from the same hint. It's just that I am just concerned that we don't have a practice or a precedent that is established that basically says, right, okay, we can only answer questions if the information really arises after the December 2011. That's not the position, as it transpires in these exchanges of the government. It's not the position of the opposition.
Very well, I get the gist of the point that has been raised, and I will make a ruling in due course. Insofar as it applies to Parliament, because one issue is constitutional responsibility of government within Parliament, and another matter may be what happens outside Parliament, where the government may have a constitutional responsibility with regard to the general public. Okay? So that will be, it will purely be directed to Parliament. Now, the Honourable Mr. David Philip mentioned a question in 2001. Okay? The Honourable Lady was not a member of the House of Parliament in 2001, and therefore she has no obligation to be informed about any answer that was given in Parliament in 2001, unless her department, in drafting answers for the file where that information may be available. If her department has a file in which answers having been answered in what was then the House of Assembly, those answers have been put into that file, then a head of department or the person drafting for the minister and answering the question may be able to bring that to the notice of the minister. But other than that, he certainly has no obligation to know what went on in 2001. So I don't think that he can refer to that.
Having said that, Mr. Speaker, and because the Honourable Gentleman is suggesting in the supplementary that I am misleading Parliament in my answer, then, and he's insisting with his faithful justice that he has no solution to supplement. In his supplementary, what he refers to is admission to the summons. In his current question, his question relates to completion of treatment in this summons, Mr. Speaker, and they are not. And no, Mr. Mr. Speaker, the question, and I will read it for the sake of good order, says, can the Minister for Social Services confirm how many people completed a drug rehabilitation program between the years 2006 and 2015? Because that is the question that I have on my face. The question that I have says the word completed.
Can the Minister for Social Services confirm how many people underwent the program of rehabilitation? And question 161, confirm how many people completed the program? It hasn't been read. Then what the Minister should say, I will answer question 160 together with question 161, and then the Honourable Lady Phillips can take out 161. Okay?
Mr. Speaker, I do apologize. I had it open on the wrong page after yesterday, So, yes, I was answering the statistics that I provided was in relation to question 161 because I intended to answer both together. And having said that, Mr. Speaker, if I can preempt the answer to this one, I've noticed that actually I don't have the statistics. I haven't been provided with an answer to question 161. So I do apologize for that. I don't have the figures for those who underwent. The only figure that I'm provided with is that the people who completed treatment. So the number of people who completed treatment is 56. I haven't been given the figure for those who underwent a program between... Reading question 160. Question 160 asks how many people underwent a program between 96 to 2011, Mr. Speaker, and my answer to that is that we will not be answerable to in relation to anything that happened before the period of December 2011. So that's my answer to that, and that in any event, that I would not have, it would be impossible to collect those figures in the short period of time that we have to the question was asked. So, Mr. Speaker, I haven't made a mistake in the answer to question 160. But my answer, I did make a mistake when I thought I was answering question 160, and what I was answering was a question 161. It may be easier if the Honourable Gentleman asks question 161, and then we can have the answer on that.
Mr. Speaker, just one question before we get on to question 161. The reason why, it's a very simple reason, the reason why I asked this question was because he said in answer to the question that I put to him the last question, that he looked at the statistics after coming to office, it was clear there was only one person there. Hence the reason for asking the question. The matter was put before the House. She made a statement in relation to the number of people that were working at Business Farm together with rather inflammatory language about the state of the service at the time, and therefore I'm entitled, I believe, to ask a question relating to those number of statistics that my learned and honourable lady has said that she's seen on entering office. That's precisely the point that I'm making. The answer that she clearly has, the answer that she's clearly given shows that the impression that she gave from her answer to my question in the last session is wrong. And that's the point I'm making. I would ask, it's not a political point, I'm not party politics out of this. I'm asking the Honourable Lady to correct the record from information that she provided to this House that was incorrect. That is a simple point that I make. I would ask her to correct the record, please.
Because I don't think you understand. And yet, because he has answered his own question, Mr. Speaker. Because what I said last night, Mr. Speaker, was that when I first went to Business Farm early on, after having taken office, it was empty. So clearly, that could only have happened after the 9th of December 2011. So what we've got to do with the statistics before December 2011? I am saying that when I went to Business Farm, when I was the minister with responsibility for Business Farm, shortly after having been the minister, the place was empty. on Sundays it was empty, on Sundays there was one person there, or there could have been two people there. That was in the early days in which Mr. Cosby. So the statistics that I am referring to, what I said, and you can check on that because I'm pretty sure that that is what I said last month, was that very early on it was empty. And if it was empty very early on, it can't be attributed to anything that we did, because all we did was inherited the mechanism that was there. I have to say that I was horrified, and I will say again, I don't even like it because I'm not being reminded of what I inherited, but I was horrified to find two things when I went to visit France.
Look, I think I've been very liberal. Even in respect on having on the agenda paper, I mentioned yesterday two questions which my inclination would have been not to allow. Why? And now I've done it with a constitutional point have been raised. I'm going to make a ruling in due course. But now, as an honourable member, clearly have to come down to us and realize that we are widening the whole language of it. And advantage is being taken, really, advantage is being taken of a very generous attitude on my part. So please, keep strictly to the subject matter. I told the honourable questioner that you are not expected to deal with something that happened in 2001 because you weren't even a member. But the situation as you found it, because you're now going back to the question of the last meeting, the situation as you found it in Dr. Strong, you've made the point, please don't widen the ambit of the matter any further. And therefore, I ask the honourable questioner to do the same. Let's keep a sense of proportion. May I ask a question in relation to this, Mr. Speaker? Well, Mr. Speaker, yes, Mr. Speaker, because of course the honourable lady may be absolutely right, but in 2011 when she took office there was nobody there. But as my honourable and learned friend Mr. Elliot Phillips has pointed out, from 2003 to 2010 there were 310 admissions. And that, you know, from questions that were asked by the honourable gentleman to the left, immediately to the left of the honourable lady, Mr. Neil Costa, who asked the question. And can I ask the honourable lady that in her exhaustive search for all the statistics, which led her to believe that there was nobody there, and this is some form of clubhouse when she took office, it's the words that she used. Did she at the very least talk to her honourable colleague, Mr. Neil Foster, who quite clearly had the information when it was provided to him in answer to questions? Mr. Speaker, in my view, she had no obligation to do so. When I became a member of the House in 1972, I had no obligation as a minister to find out from my service on a radio interview or what have you, what went down in the exchanges that they made when they were sitting on that side of the house. No, I don't think that is a requirement in a parliamentary process where people are elected at a certain time and leave parliament at a certain time for that kind of continuity. No need for it.
Thank you, Peter. I think that's exactly the point that you've been making and remaking. And the only further point to make is that the Honourable Gentleman says that he seems to appreciate that the description that seems to get their back up to the matter of a crock house is a description on the morning of the 9th of December, the morning of the great new dawn of the state of the Great of the Inheritance.
Mr. Speaker, just for clarity's sake, I don't want to over-edge the point, but the question that I ask is in relation to, and it's a very simple point, Mr. Speaker, because the Hanford demonstrates to all of us here in this chamber that the minister looked at the statistics at the time. Which statistics was he looking at, Mr. Speaker?
Mr. Speaker, after December 2011, the statistics that told me that there was nobody there after 2011, Mr. Speaker, and in fact, they didn't meet statistics. I went there myself, Mr. Speaker. And because of that, Mr. Speaker, I asked the people who manage this system to send me the report in the same way that you do with hotels, where you monitor bed occupancy. I asked for bed occupancy because I wanted to know, I wanted to see the pattern where the people wanted to be admitted to this system on a Monday, a Tuesday, a Wednesday, a Thursday, a Friday. So I, actually, and I still do, get the bed occupancy for this system every day of the week and every day of the month and every month of the year, Mr. Speaker. because I want to monitor the statistics while I and this government is responsible for this economy. But I want to make the point again, Mr. Speaker. The statistics that I was referring to were the statistics of what was there when we took office in December 2011, after 2011. And the reason I said what I did in relation to the GST was because that clearly must have been the system that we inherited and the system that I wanted to surprise. And I'm sorry that it hurts you, Mr. Speaker, but that is what it was, Mr. Speaker. Yes, there may well have been other admissions in the period as referred to in that question in hindsight in 2011, but I am talking about December 2011, January 2012, February 2012, Mr. Speaker. That's what it is. I am referring to the Honourable Gentleman is insinuating that I am somehow misleading Parliament. I certainly am not.
Move on to the next question. I will do something, Mr. Speaker. May I do something? Mr. Speaker, I'm going to. All right, I'm going to ask a question, Mr. Speaker. I'll ask a question. I'm going to add the preamble to the question. If in order to be able to collect information which may be useful for either side, because at the end of the day, the ultimate aim, I think, for parties is to improve as far as possible the services offered by this reform, I formally authorize the Minister to be able to access any data that I may have left behind at this reform in respect of my days of chairman of the Trust. Yeah, where I know statistics and so on, whatever. It could help, you know, the current government or future government in order to improve the facilities. And my question is, without wanting to sort of rumble back or whatever, because of the answer given at the time when both the Honourable Neil Fox and myself were members of this parliament in 2011, we got information that gives us at least right up to 2000. I'm asking a question, Mr. Speaker. Well, let me say, my question is, well, I got information after 2010. The Minister has been able to provide us with an answer of statistics from, he says, 2012 onwards. Yes? And we're looking at figures for 2011. Would it be possible for me at some stage, if not now, you know, 2020, just to provide us a statistical figure of 2011, as well as, you know, even have it, the 56 completions since 2012, which we happen to have a breakdown of the year, you know, what the pace in 2012 to 13 or 14. It's just a complete the picture, meaning that we have 90% of it, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, yes, but that question wasn't actually asked. And the problem here is that I answered question 161 before it was actually asked, because question 160 is very defined in time, in that it only asks for the people who were admitted between 1999 and 2011, and my answer to that was that I would not answer because we are not answerable for anything before our period in office. So that is why we don't have the physical admission. The reason we don't have the physical admission is because it was not. And I have preempted the answer to question 161 by mistake before it's been asked, and I've already answered question 161, but it may be more helpful if we carry on and I give the Honourable Gentleman an opportunity to ask question 161 and at least if it isn't having any effect on it would be in relation to the right question and question 160, because I did intend to answer them both together. Just as it happened, I had my file open from yesterday and I had it open on the right page.
Question 161. Question number 161, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Can the Minister for Social Services confirm how many people completed a drug rehabilitation program, treatment program between the years 1996 and 2015?
I refer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Quality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, my answer, which is the answer to 160 and 161, which I'm taking together, is answer them. This government is not answerable for an act prior to the 8th of December 2011. And the collation of material going back 20 years in 5 working days is an unrelent in the discipline. But since 2000, since January 2012, 56 people have completed the treatment.
Just to take clarity from the 1st of January 2012, until 2015. This month, 56 people. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, but we're not in 2015, we're in 2016.
Does the Minister have a breakdown for each year, 2012, 13, 14, 15, and past and past 2016?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, in relation to completion of the programme, for 2012 we had 14 people, 2015 15 people, 2014 14 people, and for 2015 13 people.
Question number. Is there a practical difference in terms of the numbers between undergoing a programme and completing a programme? And can the Honourable the Minister perhaps provide some information in relation to that, please?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, there is a considerable difference between admitting and people who complete the programme. Because actually completing the programme is very, very difficult. And it may be, in some occasions, people are admitted and they are not ready. No one can force someone to either undergo a drug rehabilitation program or complete a drug rehabilitation program. I think it's very, very difficult, and the person has to be in the right place and in the right frame of mind in order to do so. And while some people may be very keen to undergo drug rehabilitation treatment, because it's so difficult, not everybody succeeds. Or not everybody succeeds on the first occasion. It depends on the person, it depends on the situation, and it depends on their level of addiction. And it may be that for some people, it takes 3, 4, even 5 admissions for them to be clean and to stay clean. It may be that people are admitted, complete the program, relapse, and need to be readmitted again. There's all sorts of different combinations in relation to admission and readmission. Regrettably, this is something that there is no magic wand for drug treatment and drug rehabilitation. Everybody wants to help an addict, and I think that nobody who's an addict wants to be an addict. But it's very, very difficult to get out of addiction.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that's exactly what I thought. And of course, it's unfortunate that people fall off the wagon, so to speak. People don't complete it. Have to undertake a program again. And therefore, I was wondering, in order to actually see how many people are undertaking the program and then comparing it to how many people are completing the program, I wonder whether the Honourable Lady has a statistic of how many people underwent the program during their term in office. If you have the statistics there, as opposed to completing, obviously.
No, Mr. Speaker, what I could have is details of admission. But we can have situations where people are admitted and leave the following day. People may be admitted on a Friday, leave on a Monday. So how far does that constitute undergoing a program? There are some people who are admitted for a few days and they may then undergo the program in the community. People do 50-50. But one of the things that I introduced, in fact, in December 2011 was the support in completing the 12-step program in the community for people who find it difficult to be in this time for the 3 months for which the 12-step program requires. So a very narrow interpretation of these statistics doesn't actually give an accurate overview of the situation, Mr. Speaker, because it's sometimes very, very difficult to monitor. We try as much as we can, but it is a little bit, but at least what I am much more comfortable with now, much happier, is that admissions are up, and we've never had a situation where we've not had anybody in the response. Thankfully, I've not had, when I review my statistics, I've never in the last few years had statistics that tell me that they're just in 3 years.
So can you tell us how many people have been admitted into Bruce's farm from the 1st of January 2012 all the way to February of 2016.
Mr. Speaker, that question was not put to me, but of course the Honourable Gentleman is free to ask that in the next parliamentary session.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Minister for that explanation. I think that will go somewhere. It's actually pleasing to see that the work's been done in the community to also reinforce the 12-step programme, and I remember the spirit that side of the work that we do here in relation to that, and I'm sure the few people in the community undergoing that program within the community outside Dr. Peter's farm. That's important work, and I congratulate them with respect to that work which we is doing. One of the questions, supplementary questions I'd like to know is that I know the Chief Minister said yesterday that there have been significant increases in relation to admissions, and the Minister has alluded to that point again. Is there a reason, has the government looked into the reasons for increased admissions for people with addiction problems and alcohol and drugs?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and in fact, what we did was the starting point in 2011 was looking at why people were not going to be farming person, and there were several very significant stumbling blocks in relation to admission, in relation to the management and administration of the place once people were there. And there was all sorts of problems in relation to admission. People had to jump through hoops and all sorts of hurdles to get there. So we have facilitated that, and we have changed the protocol to facilitate admission, but more importantly, to make the stay of the service user much more comfortable, because we wanted to do two things. Of course, I inherited a problem where there was nobody there. So clearly, there was nobody there. Nobody can undergo reading. I wanted to make sure that we had an increase in admission. Mr. Speaker, I know that the leader of the opposition didn't announce it when I reminded others, but it is a fact. Mr. Speaker, so when I see something and I see that there is a problem, clearly, if it is a drug rehabilitation centre that doesn't have a high occupancy level, it means that somewhere there must be a problem. So I need to look back and see what the problem is. One of the problems was that people found it difficult to be admitted because of the cumbersome procedure which was streamlined. People were not happy when they were there because of certain policies and procedures which we looked at and we facilitated to encourage people to be there. And of course, very importantly, the makeup of the place and the structure of the place, it has been left to fall into disrepair. And I know that there are people who were very passionate about setting up Peter's Farm initially in 1999 when it was a charity, but unfortunately, those people were not very responsible for it towards the latter part of the GSD. And while I do not blame them as individuals for it falling into disrepair, the reality is that it wasn't a comfortable place to go to, Mr. Speaker. So, we did look into that, and people have now been, I think, happier to be admitted to Peter's Farm. And I have to reiterate one of the points that when people are admitted to Peter's Farm, they are guaranteed complete anonymity. And that is a very important factor in relation to admission.
Question number 162, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, the Minister for Equality has confirmed that in the context of the proposed amendments to the Marriage Act to make provision for same-sex marriage, religious denominations will not be forced to change their practices, beliefs, and sacraments in any way. How does the government intend to deal with a registrar of marriages refusing to marry a same-sex couple on the grounds of religious belief?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Policy, and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, the government is presently considering the responses received to the command paper on equal marriage, and it would be inappropriate to deal with issues such as that raised in the question before the government has announced the conclusion it has reached after a full assessment of that consultation.
questions numbers 163 and 164 have already been called out, so we move to question 165, the Honourable E. J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Housing confirm that the government has ruled out the introduction of means testing for the allocation of government rental accommodation?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Quality, Social Services and Housing.
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 156, the Honourable E.J. Davis.
Mr. Speaker, well, we're to the answer to question number 42 of 2016. Has anyone made any further decision in respect to the possible sale till tender of the 77 homes identified for this purpose?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Children, Equality, Social Services and Health.
I will answer this question together with question 167.
Question number 167, the Honourable E.J. Davis.
Further to the answer given to question number 42 of 2016, can government say what it intends to do with the 66 homes classified as beyond economical repair?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Speaker, the tender process for the number of these homes has already been completed and these have been removed from the housing stock and the remainder continue to be considered and tenders will be issued in the usual way. These properties are being reviewed by the government's land management committee, the aim of which is to maximise the properties or the space in the area in which they are.
Question number 168, the Honourable E.J. Harris.
The Speaker, that further to question number 43 of 2016, can the Minister for Housing confirm if he has had an opportunity to check upon the discrepancy of information provided last month via Table 822 on the government website when compared to her oral answer to the original question?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, third question number 43, I can confirm that I checked on the discrepancy arose as a result of an input in the spoken to the name.
Question 169 has already been called out. We move to question 170, the Honourable E.J. Bailey.
Speaker, can the Minister for Housing provide detailed information in respect of any legal costs incurred relating to the eviction of quarters from rental homes since the answer given to question number 48 of 2016, together with any possible information as to how these quarters may have come about to unlawfully occupy a home?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Quality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, none.
Question number 171, the Honourable E.J. Hill.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of how many tenants required urgent defending from their homes since the answer given to question number 49 of 2016, indicating the reason why and the date when said defending became necessary?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 172.
Question number 172, the Honourable E.J. Hill.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of how many tenants who required urgent detention have still not been able to return to their homes, as well as provide estimated dates by when they should be able to do so?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, since the answer given to question 49 of 2016, Three tenants have required to be decommitted. One in January to Infogu due to a fire and a police investigation. All three tenants returned to their flats in prison.
I know those three tenants have returned. What I'm saying as well in question 172, yes, are there any tenants who either of the three that have required the decanting since question 49 or prior to that, are there still any who have not been able to return to the homes, and therefore the latter part of my question was, you know, would the minister happen to have estimated dates when they should be able to return to those homes?
Mr. Speaker, my understanding from the answer provided is that they have already.
And Mr. Speaker, would this happen to know how about the decision taken? Who takes the decision based upon what that satisfies someone, a tenant that can say, right, urgent decanting is required from this record?
Well, Mr. Speaker, obviously it depends on the circumstances. In these cases, it's, I think, quite clear because there has been a reason for the decanting and that it was a fire. If someone is decanted as a result of a fire, I think it's quite urgent that they need to be decanted from their property. So obviously it depends on the circumstances.
Mr. Speaker, may I ask the Minister, I don't want to waste the whole time. May I ask the Minister, would she indulge me just a few minutes of her time later during our COVID break behind the Speaker's chair? Because there seems to be sort of a bit of a misunderstanding by certain tenants who claim that they have certificates, for example, issued by the Electricity Authority, whereby they have classified their cut off the electricity supply to the home, they classified it as being urgently not suitable and so on. And there could be misunderstanding. I think it's better when it seems a lot more in the minutes of leave and we meet later, but it's just for a few minutes to allow her to say something about it. Is that possible?
Yes, of course, Mr. Speaker, and indeed it would be possible at any time before Parliament, if that means that it doesn't necessarily have to result in a parliamentary question. I'm always at the end of the gentleman's stage.
Question number 173, the Honourable E.J. Hager.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Housing provide details in respect of all expenditure incurred since the answer given to question number 50 of 2016 in respect of contracts awarded for making empty homes suitable for relocation, stating to whom payments were made, how much has been paid in respect of work for each individual home, as well as indicating the type and nature of the fair work undertaken?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Tourism, Quality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, no.
Question number 174, the Honourable E.J. Hayley.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details pertaining to the house size requirements in respect of the 413 applicants who joined any category of housing waiting list prior to the 8th of December 2011 and who are still waiting for a location or assignment of a rental home?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, there are 231 applicants on the one RKV waiting list. The remainder are either applicants who are adequately housed in civil authorization or who have received notification of allocation.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, the Minister may need to close the hearing for me. In looking at the answer to question number 45 in the list that we finally provided in the breakdown per year, up to 2011, I reached a figure of 413. As that, from the answer, I think that figure has changed substantially. Perhaps the Minister can enlighten me.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, because when we were asked this question, I noticed that there was an error in the previous question, in that there were some people who had already been given allocations but had nothing, the information hadn't been extracted from that particular table. So I've double-checked this answer and this is the correct answer.
Okay, so then, However, the feeling is there's an error in the figures provided by question 45. Would the minister concede they'll be able to provide me a revised answer for question 45? Otherwise, this one is a piece of name on the record, and the minister just said that it needs to be updated. This is one to leave your understanding that when we can provide that information.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, of course, and we only noticed this a couple of days ago in preparation for this, and we also noticed other mistakes from the Honourable Member, and I have already discussed it, and I'm grateful for his assistance.
Question number 175, the Honourable A.J. Harris.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker. Can the Minister for Housing provide updated details in his sector by when government intends to do away with the housing treatment as per the 2011 manifesto commitment?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Quality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, our performance in respect to our magnificent 2011 New Deal manifesto was judged by 7 out of 10 voters at the recent general election to have been exemplary. And we have now embarked on an equally exemplary record of performance in respect of our 2015 from the Foundation's general election manifesto and our housing commitment are contained therein.
Question number 176, the Honourable E.J. Haley.
The Speaker, further information provided at table 828 on the government's website in respect of lists servicing government rental homes. Can the Minister for Housing provide details, if any, of the 26 points reported have been attributed to vandalism?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Quality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, 4 points can be attributed to the wrongful use of the lift or vandalism.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Minister may recall in the past, I had the habit of submitting written questions if you could give me a schedule, and there was a column that had breakdown thoughts. Looking at the table now available in the website, there may be requests now for me to have to ask a given question because most of the information is right there. However, Mr. Speaker, in our written answers, where is that breakdown force? It actually joins the description, for example, cabin door force. Then one could deduce that, you know, had to be biological, a sort of vandalism, or even the door. In those of you in the answer saying it's four, I'm lacking that sort of information, you know, whether. Just to pick up on the trend, you know, whether it's because the doors have been forced open or what it is. If the minister doesn't have it now, could be a deep conversation if they hope to continue providing active information via the website, that a column similar to how you should in the written schedule be included. And then if I was my having to pose the question either in written or in oral format, then maybe the education or the communication, but it certainly is helped to expedite the proceedings of this house.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I certainly consider that, but I am in a position to give the Honourable Gentleman the information that he's asking now, and he will be as horrified to learn as I am, that the first 2 faults are occasioned because of a plastic bag worked into the cabin door. The other one is because the doors were manually forced open. And in the fourth occasion, again, the cabin doors were forced open and the door mechanism was on.
Question number 177, the Honourable E.J. Harris.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of what effective actions it is implementing in order to prepare the unfortunately increasing anti-poaching behaviour being experienced in housing estates?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Health.
Mr. Speaker, the Housing Department has policies in place to deal with antisocial behaviour, and where relevant and if necessary, will refer matters to the World Health Organization.
Would the Minister happen to have information that
payment of state assessment. Expenses incurred, 375,402, and the net cost of report is 108,091.
Question number 179, the Honourable E.J. Hilliard.
Mr. Speaker, I still write to the answer to question number 38 of 2016. Can the Minister for Housing name which blocks of flats within the rule of state and included within the completion date given for each phase of the ongoing development?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 180, 181 and 182.
Question number 180, the Honourable E.J. Hilliard.
Can the Minister for Housing provide updated estimated completion dates in respect of the different phases pertaining to the installation of lifts within the rental housing estate currently being refurbished, indicating which block of flats pertain to which phase for this purpose?
Question number 181, the Honourable E.J. Hilliard.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of completion dates in respect of any new lifts already installed during the current financial year within any housing estate, together with details of any breakdowns these newly installed lifts may have already experienced?
Question number 182, the Honourable D.A. Keating.
And if Speaker, can the government please explain what is the current position in respect to the installation of lifts at Laguna and World Class Estate?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Equality, Social Services and Housing.
Mr. Speaker, in answer to question 179, I now hand to any of the member of February with the names of the blocks in each phase. I'm not sure whether the Honourable Member heard my response, and I know for some reason I don't pick it up. But in answer to question 180, the estimated completion dates remained as were answered in question 38 of 2016. In the case of Laguna Estate, which has three phases, the block in each phase can be found in the February in answer to question 179, which is the one that I just handed the Honourable Gentleman. And no new lifts have been installed in this financial year other than those installed under the refurbishment programme, which is yet to be commissioned. And in answer to question 182, the installation of lifts go hand in hand with the unprecedented and excellent external refurbishment programme which the government has completed. And are progressing according to its magnificent project completion date for each individual stage in Laguna and North Carolina.
Mr. Speaker, the Minister has said that in this current financial year, the those that may have already been installed have not been yet commissioned. Am I right then, in deduction from them, that the estimated commissioning dates are those pertaining to the same year, or are there any other different dates that are not contained here, perhaps pertaining to other blocks or lists, because these here, for example, do not include anything on the Moorish Castle, and I believe there are some lists as well assigned to Moorish Castle 6.
Mr. Speaker, he's correct in that the lists are installed but not commissioned. They'll be commissioned by the date of completion. And in Laguna Estate, there are three, the completion will take place in three phases, and I'm outlining in the schedule the blocks that relate to each phase. But in relation to my party, Mr. Speaker, I already indicated the completion date in the answer last month, and as I've just answered now, that completion date will not change. That's why I don't include all the lists, because there's only one phase for completion in motion.
Question number 3 has already been called, so we now move to question 184. The question is the Honourable Ellis Lennox.
How many people have been granted disabled parking permits since December 2011
providing details of such aid and conditions for conditions. Answer the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services. Mr. Speaker, we'll ask this question today with question 185. Question number 185, the Honourable Ellis Yamas.
What is the process to consider the disability parking permit application detailing who is involved during the process?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services. Mr. Speaker, the department has issued 605 permits since 2011. There are currently 496 active badges. After consulting with the Data Protection Division of the Gibraltar Registry Authority, we are not able to release this sensitive personal information, as such individuals would be easily identifiable from the breakdown requested. Releasing this information would be contravening the Data Protection Act. Mr. Speaker, applications for disabled persons' badges are received at the Driver and Vehicle Licensing Department as the issuing authority for these parking permits. The prescribed application form is comprised of two parts, the second of which is required to be completed by the applicant's doctor. And all other applications are received by the issuing department, need to refer to the medical advisory panel, which comprises of a doctor, the VHA's head of professional services, and senior members of the department. In this regard, the panel carefully assesses all applications and may advise for approval or reject applications after considering the applicant's disability in accordance with the provisions of the Traffic, Parking and Waiting Regulations of 2011.
Thank you very much for the answer. Just going back to the panel that assesses these applications and makes recommendations as to whether government accepts the application or rejects it. Is there any involvement from any civil servant or minister who may reject a recommendation from the panel?
Mr. Speaker, that is done independently, so if I inquire, I can find out for example this process is actually the question of the government done was asked to make it for the first time look at exactly what the medical conditions are, for example, if I was not aware of that. It's taken down by recommendation of the medical advisory panel, and it's in their recommendation that the permit is either granted or denied.
Question number 186, the Honourable Ellis Yamas.
In relation to the tanker board has been exported out of DGTW Fiber, RGC was pilot vessel last February 2016. Is any other vessel which has arrived in DGTW and left the Spain shortly after arrival? Can government explain what was the initial purpose of their visit?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services. Mr. Speaker, I'll answer questions today with questions 187 and 188.
Question number 187, the Honourable Ellis Yamas.
Have any fees been left outstanding to the Gibraltar Government or the Gibraltar Port Authority in relation to a transfer bordering exported out of PGTW by the RGC as private vessel last February 2015? Or any other vessel which has done the same since December 2011.
Question number 188, the Honourable Ellis Yamas.
In relation to the tanker boarded and exported out of CCW by the RGC pilot vessel last February 2016, why did the Gibraltar Port Authority not previously attend to this decision?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services. Mr. Speaker, the Gibraltar Port Authority launch did not attend to the situation as it was not available at the time. In any case, there would be no purpose for the launch to attend in these circumstances. Furthermore, there is no requirement for pilotage for vessels departing the Gibraltar Port waters from the Western Anchorage. The Gibraltar Port Authority cleared the vessel in question by VHF radio to weigh anchor and proceed out of the Gibraltar Port waters, as is customary for these types of movements. By the time it was known that the Algeciras pilot had embarked on board the vessel, it was already underway and heading towards Spanish waters.
the vessel in question was in Jesus' ability to carry out a 66-ounce operation in the bay. It is not uncommon for vessels to anchor in DGCW for bunkers or other services, crew changes, stores, surveys, etc., before shifting into Spanish waters to conduct other business. The agent for the bunker, SKS Mosel, had been invoiced for an amount of £2,375. The invoice was issued on the 4th of February 2016. No other arrears are outstanding since 2011. In respect to vessels who have called at Gibraltar and then continue their voyage to their port of call in the same circumstances.
Okay, just as what the Honourable Minister has just said, the launch is unavailable, albeit perhaps it would have been non efficient to attend the situation in any event. But may I ask if the Honourable Minister does know why the launch is unavailable?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the launch was out of service, not being questioned, because it was undergoing refit and repairs.
Just a quick supplementary. Has it been, is it fit for service now?
Mr. Speaker, General Ellis is now ready, it's undergoing its final trials, and once that is completed, then it will be operating.
Can I just confirm then that the vessel is under trial at the moment, so the port does not have a vessel available to it, or it does have a vessel available, and there is no vessel available to it. So I'm not sure out of my own ignorance in this event.
Mr. Speaker, the two vessels which are currently available for use in the port are one has just undergone an extensive refit after many years of it not being up to standard. And the other vessel is undergoing the repairs.
So my understanding is that there are two vessels available, but neither is available on this occasion. In such circumstances, it must be undesirable for the port not to have any rights available to it. Is there any kind of provision for another agency to provide them with a launch in these circumstances, or perhaps to cover the role that would otherwise be carried out by that vessel?
When it's necessary, we can access the service. At the present time, as you already say, it's not ideal not to have the two services both available, but it's one of these things, and as just mentioned, should there be a need for it, then the service is and will be outsourced.
May I ask if the service is outsourced, to whom is it normally outsourced, which agency would normally take that responsibility?
Mr. Speaker, the way that happens normally is the service is outsourced, and whoever's available at the moment in time are the operators. So if there is a vessel available, then they will have to outsource the crew from different agents available to us within the port. But they take port staff on board, it's not the agent.
So the vessel that would be used would actually belong to a private entity, it wouldn't be a police vessel or other such.
Mr. Speaker, that's correct. The vessel would be a private vessel, which would be outsourced, and you would carry on board and port crew.
Just for my own clarification, does the Minister know the invoice that has been raised of £2,235? In relation to what services it has been engaged by the new police?
I'm not entirely sure, but I'm being informed it must be the anchorage fees. I mean, if you want to extract these and say that, or if you can find it in place of but they are comprised of anchorage fees and not merely.
Question number 189, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Mr. Speaker, can government say how many applicants have applied for berths in the small boat marina
and the estimated date by which they will be able to have full use of these facilities.
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, as at the 19th of February 2016, the number of applicants who have applied for work in the small boat marina is 1,131. The marina has not been handed over by the contractors yet. However, the Gibraltar Port Authority has already started the allocation process.
I appreciate that the contractor hasn't heard over yet, but
does the minister happen to have an indication, a different rough date by which time they would be able to have the use of the facility?
I will answer that because I gave a date last month on when the marina was going to be handed over. The date I gave last month was the 14th of February, because that was the date that was given to us by the contractor at the time, it was in January. There has been a little bit of slippage, and there was a few weeks delay. There is still some extra work to be done, and we expect the marina to be handed over towards the end of March.
I won't be able to, but I mean, I expect the delay to happen if the developer or the contractor hands over towards the end of March. How long thereafter is one assuming that those who are successful in obtaining the best will be able to start using the facility? Would it be imminent or would it be rather long term?
Because I hope that very, very soon indeed. Maybe not necessarily to coincide with the exact date, but as soon as possible thereafter, as my honourable colleague has mentioned, the allocation process has started. But clearly, there will be administrative matters to be put in place in terms of the management of the new marina. And assuming that all that is in place, then those who have been allocated there can start using the marina as soon as it is handed over to government by the contractor.
Question number 119, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
The Speaker, sir. Can Diamond say whom it was appointed as members of the advisory board in respect to the small boat marina, and for what period of time have these appointments been made?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the Small Vessels Marine Control Rule 2016, which provides the criteria for the allocation of berths at the mid-harbour small boat marina, also establishes the Small Vessels Advisory Board, which will report to the Minister for the Port and invite the Captain of the Port on matters concerning mooring facilities for small vessels. The board will also be able to hear complaints from holders of or applicants for permits. Appointments to the board will be for a period of 3 years. No appointments have yet been made.
Mr. Speaker, given that we are under the date towards the end of March, and I'm wishing the government all the best in being able to have the boat using this as soon as possible, hopefully in the month of April. Since no appointments have been made, can the Minister say by when he intends to have the appointments to the board in place?
Speaker, can I deal with the premise of the question first, and then perhaps the Minister can answer the specific question on the appointment? Because the premise of the question is in relation to the advisory board in respect of the small boat marina. That sense is in fact incorrect. This is not an advisory board in respect of the small boat marina. It's an advisory board that is established by the rules generally in order to advise the minister and to advise the captain of the port in relation to small vessels and mooring across the board and in relation to hearing of complaints and other matters that the board. So the board, the establishment of the board, is totally independent, separate, unconnected in a way with the finishing off the completion of the small boat marina and the functioning of the small boat marina. It is an advisory board on small vessels and mooring generally across various matters and not specifically related to the small boat marina. And this is not a board that will have any management or control in respect of the small boat marina. And and the running of the small boat marina, the new marina itself.
Oh, that's extremely interesting. I think I'm grateful. Am I right then in using that the members of the board would have the ambit of their scope of responsibility in the map of advisory go well beyond just the area concerned or something? And if that is the case, I'm eternally grateful for that. It does carry for the picture for the future.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that is indeed correct, and that is why I wanted to stress that the premise of the question that is related to the small boat marina might create a wrong impression, because this is an advisory board to advise generally in relation to small boats, and they have specific functions set out in the rules to advise on marine in designated areas. One of the designated areas is the new small boat marina, but that's not the only designated area there is in respect of mooring, and they have functions in relation to appeals, etc., which go well beyond the small boat marina, but certainly in relation to the marina itself, they have no function other than generally advising the minister and the captain of the boat.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I wonder whether the minister has really sort of answered. He doesn't get the impression that municipal advisory is going to come in later. Having now had a clearer picture in terms of responsibility of the board, I still have pending sort of by when is there an estimated date by when this board is going to be appointed.
As soon as reasonably possible. The situation that has been given one of the composition of the board, and we're still at the very early stages of calling people in. So only a relatively small number of potential first holders have been called in. So, it's still a little early for us.
But this has nothing at all to do with the speaker. I understand the amount of the business, but it has nothing to do with just the first holder of the video. It's a wider relative. Please enlighten me. I'm not a lawyer and I'm probably totally lost.
So the Honourable Member, I'm glad the Honourable Member will give it away. I'll give it away. Just to clarify and to avoid any confusion, one thing is the process of allocation of birth in relation to the small boats marina and the composition or the establishment of a committee to run the marina. And that committee, in the first instance, will be selected as an interim committee by the Council of the Reporters for this exercise. And then, once the proposers and the stakeholders of the marina are there, they will select their own committee. That is a separate process from the establishment of and the composition of the advisory board, which, as I indicated, has a wider competence than just related to the small boat marina. And just to confirm the position stated by my honourable friend, the composition of the board itself is currently under consideration in terms of who should be appointed to the board, but clearly as soon as possible. But it does not detract from the allocation of birth and the opening of the small boat marina. Although related in some way under the rules, one thing doesn't depend on the other. And one does not depend on the other, therefore the users of the small boat marina can have a committee and so on, totally independent and not being delayed or whatever. Would the minister, it's not the way to hear, but I know the speaker is very generous in this matter. This sort of establishing of a committee of the small boat marina, can the minister indicate to us by when you would like to see this happening? That is the process that is controlled by the captain of the port, and it depends on the allocation of the berth. Once the process is a little bit more advanced in terms of who the berth holders will be, then the captain of the port will appoint the interim committee. But clearly, it is advisable to have that done as soon as possible, so that the interim committee is in place to take over the management of the marina once it is handed over by the contractor to the government, and by the government in turn to the association that is established by the Small Vessels Mooring Control Rules 2016.
Speaker, may I ask another supplementary arising out of answers that have been provided? The Honourable the Minister for Justice mentioned the committee in order to deal with issues arising out of the Small Boat Marina, and what he said was the interim committee is going to be set up by the captain of the port, and then afterwards the
both owners, who have their share, will then be selecting their own committee. Can you confirm that that is going to be done exclusively by the both owners, and there is going to be no administrative possible interference, in inverted commas, I use that word without any political connotation, from the capital of the court or anybody else, and it's just going to be exclusively those members selecting that committee? That is going to be the case, and that is the only way that it can be done. Those that are allocated best in the new marina will be the stakeholders, and it will be in their interest to manage the marina in the best way possible, subject to the rules and subject to the raising of revenue that's set out for in terms of fees that's set out in the rules. But the only people that can be and will be capable of selecting a committee to run the small boat marina will be the best holders themselves. Clearly, we have to have a transitional provision. In terms of establishment of the new marina, the allocation of berths, creating an interim management structure through the establishment of that committee, and the rules, we have decided to set out the rules as a matter of legislation so that it is clear to everyone what the criteria is for the allocation, what the process is, and it is the captain of the force that has the power to choose the interim committee. And once the interim committee is in place, they will have a constitution for the new marina. That constitution will then require or allow the calling of a meeting, and once the meeting of all the members takes place, then the members themselves, who will be the birth holders and therefore the stakeholders of the new marina, will be at liberty either to ratify the interim committee or select a new committee amongst their own, or in whichever way they consider it appropriate. But I can confirm that the people that will be running the marina will be the best holders in place.
Peter, may I ask the honourable member, when he says running the marina, does that mean to say they will be collecting the fees charged to the boat and deciding how that should be expended?
Peter, the rules provide what the original arrangement would be. Clearly, there is no committee in place in Italy, and therefore, on allocation, there is provision for an initial fee to be paid and then an annual fee to be paid on a calendar basis, and therefore, whatever, if someone is given a birth in, say, on the 1st of April, then they will pay two-thirds of the annual fee that is payable for the first year. Those fees will be paid initially to the support authority. But the rules provide, in terms of transitional provision, in fact, Rule 18.2 provides that all the fees that are paid, both in terms of the initial fees and the annual billing fees, all those fees are held on trust by the government or the judicial support authority for the benefit of the association that is established for the running of the marina. And therefore, all fees that are paid accrue for the benefit of the marina itself. And in subsequent years, clearly the initial allocation and initial payment will be done by the port authority, and the collection of the fees is done by the port authority. But clearly established in legislation, not government revenue, held on trust for the benefit of the members through the association. We've been very, very clear in establishing that. What happened subsequently? Well, subsequently, by the 1st of January 2017, there will be a supervisory committee which has been elected, and they will be charged with collecting fees. And the fees, again, will accrue for the benefit of the running of the marina. And the rules actually provide that the fee structure has to contain three elements. Firstly, it has to provide for the replacement in due course, because the guarantee is given of the gangways and pontoons for a period of 25 years, and therefore there has to be a sinking fund, a reserve fund built up over that period, so that we don't get to 25 years' time, there is a need to replace pontoons or replace gangways, and there is no money available. So therefore there is a requirement for the fees to include a provision for the reserve fund, sinking fund, for the replacement of the pontoons. I believe it's in the year 2041, in 25 years' time. There is then provision to be made for the annual maintenance program for the marina, in order to make sure that it is maintained
properly. And the third one is the normal operational cost. For example, if there are security guards or cleaning or the normal operational cost, any other staff that there might be. So those are the three limits that we require that the committee take into account in establishing the fees.
And because the government has made a very significant investment and has an interest in making sure that it is kept properly, maintained properly, and operated in a manner whereby sufficient funds are created to avoid, in 25 years' time, not having the money, there is also a requirement in the rules that although it is for the association to set the fees and collect the fees, the budget needs to be approved by the Council of the Board, just to have oversight and approval of that budget. Not for the purpose of interfering with the management, but to make sure that the provisions which are set out in the rules and to the requirements of what the fees are for, that those are properly set through by the association and approved by the Council of the Board. So I hope the honourable member will accept that this is a well thought out structure, well intentioned, and it augurs well for the future of the marina and the proposal.
Mr. Speaker, the honourable gentleman must have done some calculations when he introduced the fee structure and as to how much revenue is going to be raised under the various categories. I mean, I've done the calculation myself. And if we're simply talking, and of course very difficult, but an average boat size across the board, it's going to average out at about £1,000, all the fees, £1,000 per berth a year. That's my calculation, which is about £700,000 a year. Is that near the calculation the honourable gentleman has come up with? And what I've done is, I've looked at the there's one clause in particular in the rules that the charging out of the berth depends on the size of the boat. So I've averaged the size of the boat in order to basically come to this particular figure.
No, Mr. Speaker, I don't want to be controversial, but maths is not the case for the Israeli members. That is not going to be the average annual fee. There was an initial fee paid, about £365. That's the initial fee that everybody pays, regardless of the size of the boat. Multiplying 365 by 700 berths gets to around a quarter of £1 million. And the primary purpose of that initial fee is to start building that reserve fund that I mentioned. So there is £250,000. Top of my head, I think it's £255,000 that is collected through that initial fee. Then there is an annual fee which has a minimum threshold of £365 as we set out £1 a day for the annual fee for each berth as a minimum. But it depends on the size of the boat. And there is a formula which is £27 times the length, maybe breadth of the boat. I'm not sure what the average will be, but if the average was something like £500 per boat, then we're talking of maybe another £300,000 per year, or £350,000, or a little bit more, per year. The initial amount, the initial £250,000 or £255,000, that is a one-off. That is only available on the initial allocation in the first year. Clearly, if there are subsequent allocations, an initial fee will also be paid, but it will be sporadic and one-off. But the bulk will come in on the first year. But certainly the amount that will be available on a yearly basis will depend on the factors that I set out before. Because these are the fees that are set out in the rules in respect of the initial allocation and the first year's annual fee. The formula that is set out is the first year's annual fee. As from January 2017, it will be for the association to set the fee for 2017. Therefore, the fee that will be payable, which will no longer include the annual fee, the initial fee of £365, the fee that will be payable as from January 2017 will be calculated by the association having regard to the three factors that I mentioned: the sinking fund, the operational expenses, and the annual maintenance program. they will have to do a budget of what that will cost, and then set fees for that year in accordance with that budget. So all we can say is have an estimate of what will be collected in the first year. Second year will depend on the budget that is set out, and in regards to those three factors set out in the rules.
This is a math, may not be my forte, but I wasn't far off. In fact, the only mistake that I've actually made is that the initial fee is just a one-off, and that's where but in fact, if one takes that out of the equation, it wouldn't be far off. But thank you very much. Question number 191, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Transport say if any of the blue man buses remain in service with the Gibraltar Bus Company?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, I ask this question to go to question 192.
Question 192, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Can the Minister for Transport say how each of the man buses owned by the Gibraltar Bus Company has been disposed of?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, none of the man buses are blue and none have been disposed of.
Mr. Speaker, can I confirm then that all of the buses that were previously operated on the route, the man buses, are still within the service of the Gibraltar Bus Company?
Mr. Speaker, none of the man buses have been disposed of.
But the question is, are they still in service with the Gibraltar Bus Company?
Mr. Speaker, the man buses are in service. We have around 22 man buses which are currently operating on the road in colour.
So can I just confirm then that none of the buses that were previously in service, I'm presuming I was under the impression that there were man buses, but apparently not, I'm led to believe, are currently in service with the Gibraltar Bus Company?
That is correct, Mr. Speaker.
I should follow up next time with a question reference how those buses have been disposed of.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I understand there may have been a mistake about describing them as man buses. But clearly the question is about the blue buses. I mean, it's the buses that we contracted for when we were in government. I can't, at the top of my head, remember whether they were man buses or what they were. But the blue buses. Now, in relation to the blue buses, have any of those been disposed of? That's the question that's been asked, and surely the Honourable the Minister must have information there. Mr. Speaker, the old buses which were at the first stage, you see that the Danish staff buses, and they were blue in colour. And that's what the old member is searching, and Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that none of the blue Danish staff buses in any service will be going to that company today. These have been disposed of as follows. In fact, we have two buses which are transferred to EDEC, which is the Economic and Development Employment Company for driver training. So we actually operate a training program where we train our buses by using two of these old buses. Two further buses were completely beyond economical repair, and those form the basis of they were actually given to the airport fire service for training purposes. We have a team in the press recently which was put alive for training purposes. 14 of the remaining buses, some were in extremely poor condition. They were sold together to collective transport for their use. in their bus company.
Would the minister know of any of those buses which were transferred to collective transport and service to the public?
Mr. Speaker, yes, of all the buses that were considered, the 14 total, a few are that we put out of all the buses that were seen together, might be seen together. And they're actually there at the moment. I can't tell you how many there are actually in there.
Mr. Speaker, we have to be very careful that we're just giving the level of government an impression. Well, we don't know what Calypso is doing with the bus, neither are we answering it today.
Is Calypso the operator that operates the service from the frontier to the city? I don't know whether the Honourable Gentleman knows that. Who are the operators of Calypso? Calypso transport operates the number five, which is from the frontier to marketplace via the connection road.
Question number 193, the Honourable T.M. Hind.
Can the Minister of Transport say when the GPS bus tracker and associated app will be available for use by the public?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, my government expects to be in a position to announce the launch of a resource to bus tracker web app very soon.
Can I come back to the previous question in relation to the blue buses? The Honourable the Minister may not be able. I don't think there is a why this is.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable the Minister perhaps help me with this and provide me with the information of how much those blue buses have been disposed of to Calypso? Do you have that information there?
Mr. Speaker, these 14 buses were sold for £15,000. Question number 194, the Honourable T.M. Hand.
Mr. Speaker, further to written question number 6 of 2016, can the Minister for Traffic advise of the 10,620 parking tickets issued to local registered vehicles last year, how many were paid?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, I ask this question today with question 195.
Question 195, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Further to written question number 6 of 2016, can the Minister for Traffic advise of the 534 parking tickets issued to foreign registered vehicles last year, how many were paid?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, of the 10,620 parking tickets issued to local registered vehicles last year, 7,105 have been paid to date, and that is around 66.9%. Of the 535 public tickets issued to foreign registered vehicles last year, 473 have been paid to date, or 88.4%.
Mr. Speaker, I have to tell you, it's a surprising statistic, and those charged with the collection of these, particularly in relation to foreign vehicles, ought to be commended. I would have thought, personally, when I looked at this question, I was expecting a lower figure in relation to foreign parking, which is 88.4% recovery is actually quite impressive for foreign vehicles. At 66.9% in relation to locals is less impressive, and of course, what that means is that
about a third of those parking tickets that were issued have not been paid. And can the Honourable Gentleman perhaps provide us with a flavour of the reasons why such a high proportion of local tickets are not paid?
Mr. Speaker, this is an issue where we need to be clear what it is that we're talking about and the statistics that the Honourable Member has asked for. The specific as to tickets could, for the past year, relates to a period in which, in some instances, people may not yet have had a letter reminder of a ticket, let alone a summons, because they've asked for the period last year. So, if for example, members were to ask for the parking tickets which haven't been paid from the period in 2010, for example, if that relates to parking tickets where somebody would have found a ticket on their windscreen, where they have made the decision to pay or not pay, where they would have subsequently received a letter offering the reminder of the opportunity to pay by letter, or the opportunity to challenge and go to court for the particular issue and challenge the ticket, or ultimately they just ignore the letter, be summoned. And then there might be issues as to whether summons have been properly followed up, whether people who don't even turn up on a summons are subsequently being hauled before the court, etc. But for the period last year, in many instances, for us to give the reason why people have not paid is really just a shot in the dark. I mean, some of the locals may want to dispute the ticket. They might say, I was parked properly and that's unfair, and I'm going to write in to the commissioner as this is the case, or I'm going to challenge the matter in court when the time comes. I think we need to understand that the historic issue in respect to this is one, and in respect to the snapshot of last year alone, I think it's probably too soon to speculate about the reasoning.
I know that the Chief Minister is quite right in relation to that, and perhaps I should have rephrased my question. In addition to that, of course, I recognise that the position in relation to this may be affected by various factors, not least the fact that some may go to court and may not go to court, people are in the process, perhaps, of getting paid. But let me ask this, and perhaps we find it in this way. Does the Honourable Minister, in the discharge of his duty, detect that there is any problem with the collection of parking tickets that are due, and in particular, does he detect that there might be a propensity for an increase in, for example, death due as a consequence of these tickets, or is this not an anomalous situation when one compares it to other years, if he has information or if he has done the analysis himself?
I haven't compared to other years in the past, and one other reason which also needs mentioning, some of these figures are actually counted. So whether we find that issue, that, you know, people will contest them and they may be counted to start up with. And so I don't think when you talk of local tickets and you see the reasons why, obviously the question is asked how many tickets were issued. And that doesn't necessarily mean that these tickets end up going all the way unpaid from a council, etc. And as one of the Chief Minister has also explained. So I don't think that, you know, it is leading to Jim Bartman being a clue. I think that when we do we can account for all the people, for allowing the whole process from issuing to the payment.
Mr. Speaker, if I may, first of all, the movement of the House, I must confess I was issued a ticket for any of the three. I'd like to ask the Minister, down the member, in terms of these fees that are charged, do these accrue to the government? Or the Jordan Car Park Limited, or the Car Park Limited action is made into the government?
Yes, the actual income, the car park actually collects the sum of money and then it's passed into the general account.
Question number 196, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker,
Speaker, can the government say how many no idling signs have been placed on our roads since 1st January 2012 and where have these been placed?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services. Mr. Speaker, no idling signs have never been used on our roads either before or after January 2012.
Mr. Speaker, if I could point the Minister in the direction of the Environmental Action and Management Plan, one of its objectives in terms of air quality is to continue the efforts to obtain tangible air quality improvements with the goal of going beyond minimum compliance with clean air for Europe emission target values. One of the actions it clearly states to be completed by 2013 is the placement of no idling signs at the frontier and other locations where idling is present. Can I therefore, from the Minister's answer, draw the conclusion that that particular recommendation in the Environmental Action Plan has been rejected by government?
Mr. Speaker, not yet. When you don't even ask the question of no idling, as you can see, whether he means leaving a car idling or whether it's to do with people loitering around in areas. The no idling sign is not something which, in my looking at the way Europe works, and I've actually had the question asked, different my answer has been asking around. No idling is typically the US, sign, something in the United States. I'm not aware of any no ID signs being used in any other part of Europe.
Mr. Speaker, can I just make clear that the nomenclature isn't mine, it is the government's nomenclature has produced in their own report, their own Environmental Action Management Plan, in order to improve air quality in Gibraltar. All I ask is, has the government rejected that recommendation? I think they're totally entitled to, but I think that it would be
let me give you some guidance.
You've asked the question here, and the information is purely statistical in a way. Look, they are analysing science and have never been. In your supplementary, you are perceiving something contained in a report or in a plan. That is, it's a related matter. In my view, there should have been a specific question about that. To be something to the effect, when does the government propose to implement a recommendation in such and such a time? That should be the proper question that you should have asked in the first place. Okay? I understand, Mr. Speaker, the way in which the minister answered the question is to give the impression that there is no such thing as an arriving time, whereas whether there is or not such a thing as an arriving time, the fact is, their own reports indicate that such signs will have been placed and give a deadline for the placement of those signs. That deadline has passed by 2 years now, and the original question is to determine, A, obviously, whether signs have been placed. And certainly, if these signs have not been placed, it would be good to know whether that is because the government has chosen not to pursue that particular action within their own reports.
The original question was obviously designed not to disclose that there is a report which refers to these no idling signs. If we really want to do business in this house, in the interest of the community, then the question reflects the fact that there is something in the report which the Honourable Gentleman has obviously checked has not yet happened, and then we can, through the question, prompt action if necessary. Alternatively, we can simply try to lay a trap and get an answer and then herald a scout. We can all play that game, and we can all take one scout, Mr. Speaker.
Okay, but Mr. Speaker, surely a minister acting in the discharge of his responsibilities must know that there is a report that they have that's been produced during their time that says that refers to these idling signs and refers to them a recommendation for those idling signs to be introduced. And you know, you can accuse us of learning whatever task you like, but at the end of the day, you must understand and you must know what is within your own ministerial responsibility. Indeed, when the Honourable Mr. Hammond asked the question, it was clear that the Honourable, not only did the Honourable Minister not know about this report, but the Honourable Minister then went further and said, well, it's not even a concept that is known within Europe. Well, look, it must have been known by his own government because it's in a report that they have commissioned, it's a report to them. Now, will the minister at the very least
undertake to look at that report and then perhaps write to my honourable friend and basically tell him what his position is in relation to this particular recommendation in relation to our new science, whether it is that the government is going to accept that recommendation or whether the government is going to reject it. It's simple as that.
This is good. I don't want to register that. I'll get to the bottom of this no-idling issue and see exactly, you know, where it comes from. Because I do apologize as a member of government and then to know exactly, you know, about this report. I'm not aware of the no-idling issue. But I will make the point to see exactly what the no-idling.
Question number 197, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the government say if all EU directives on fuel switching are being fully enforced by the public?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, I'll answer this question and go with question 198.
Question number 198, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Can the government say if any non-compliances with EU directives on fuel switching have been detected within the port since 1st January 2014?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, with the Board of Maritime Administration is the competent authority for the monitoring and enforcement of EU Directive 2012/33/EU as regards the sulphur content on marine fuels.
I can confirm that this marine sulphur content directive has been transposed into the water law within the Motor Fuel Composition and Content Act 2001. The directive is still effective and being enforced by the Water Maritime Administration, who have inspected for the survey division, regularly inspecting and monitoring the sampling of vessels within BGTW. Within the context of EC Directive 2012/43/EU, as regards the sulphur content of marine fuels, the Gibraltar Maritime Administration has recorded 6 non-conformities since the mandatory regime came into force up to the 19th of February 2016. All cases of non-conformity were raised with the ship operators concerned and they were instructed to rectify the matter. Question 199, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, since the opening of the office in Hong Kong, can the Minister for Finance propose to detail investments into Gibraltar as a directly or indirectly pivotal to the work of the government in the region?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, the opening of an office in Hong Kong was part of a strategy to further open avenues of commercial activity between Asia and Gibraltar. And we have worked hard these past 2 years to make this happen. This investment in time and expense, both in Gibraltar and Hong Kong, in promoting our jurisdiction, is one that has been shared by the private sector as they have supported and continue to support our trade missions there, and indeed have been taking advantage of our presence there to make additional visits to the region independently. Senior partners of law firms, accounting firms, insurance firms, fund administrators and others have all enjoyed the benefit of a Hong Kong office and the serious work of our representative there, Mr. Jason Cruz. In April this year, we will return to Hong Kong and Singapore with representatives of our financial services sector and, for the first time in a joint visit, our maritime sector. This trade mission will piggyback on the work we have been undertaking these past years in developing an ancient building bridges for our private sector. Although I am unable to give details of the commercial activity that was created, as this is clearly confidential, I am pleased to inform the member that reports I received from the private sector indicate increasing commercial links with Asia, with real business being done, and I expect some news to be made public in the near future on a number of these initiatives.
I am grateful for the Minister's response in relation to that. However, insofar as I understand the commercial sensitivity about arrangements between certain businesses in Gibraltar and businesses in Hong Kong and trying to bring investment into Gibraltar, in terms of pounds being in pence, money, and in terms of the value of that coming into our community, does the Minister have a figure for that, apart from obviously the obvious relationship to this district community? Hong Kong business and Gibraltar business, which I agree with in terms of creating business working relationships, etc. But insofar as Pan-Chinese intent, does the minister have any idea as to what investment will be coming into Gibraltar
as a result of the working region?
Yes, it's true that any vendors involved in marketing, we've had these discussions before in the previous parliament, will understand that you cannot dissect the benefits of marketing to Pan, Chinese intent in the manner that no member wishes to. Yes. So, as a consequence of that, what we rely on in everything that we do when we embark on our business plan and its formulation, the first thing that helps the community in measuring the success or otherwise is the element of private sector support that we get coming with us. But very quickly, if you suddenly find they're not coming with you to these trips, you realize that actually it's not really visit to them. But I can tell you that the visit in April will be the largest visit we've ever done to Asia. And the numbers of people coming are significant, with senior partners of firms joining us, many of whom have been there before, and some new ones, which is fantastic news. But I think you also have to look a little bit wider. If you look at, for example, what other jurisdictions have been doing in terms of representative offices, in other words, Asian Gibraltar office in Hong Kong, the first of its kind, and the answer is absolutely not, of course it isn't. I can tell you, Honourable, that JG opened up its Hong Kong office in 2009, to build an office in Shanghai, in Mumbai and Delhi. They have an office in Abu Dhabi since 2011, and they also have an office in Dubai. Guernsey has an office in Shanghai, and their office in Hong Kong opens on the 1st of March of this year. The Isle of Man has got an office in Shanghai and Beijing. The BDI has BDI Asia House in Hong Kong. And in fact, interestingly enough for the BDI, they've actually got a representative in BDI Asia House of their Financial Services Commission to engage directly with people in the jurisdiction and the surrounding areas on financial services banking. So when you look at the thinking as to why we did the Hong Kong office, and you look at what everyone else is doing, and more of them are doing it, and then you then track the responsibility of the private sector, which for me is critical, you begin to come to the very solid conclusion that it's working extremely well, even though we've already had it for barely less than 2 years. And so I believe we have a long way to go in getting the maximum out of it. But if I can give you just one number, of the 900 licensed firms in Hong Kong in investment management, 900 licensed, the Gibraltar delegations that have come through our office have met 200 of them. It's a phenomenal number. And of course, you go back to the premise that if you're not there, you don't go, you wouldn't need any of them. It's zero. So that is why the private sector is going, that is why the private sector is picking up business, and I believe that once we begin to establish a real bigger presence in Hong Kong, not in terms of the office, but in terms of the business flow that we get coming, I think that will multiply in the long term to a significant business from Asia.
I'm certainly grateful for the comprehensive answer in relation to the strategy that the government is deploying in the region, particularly in Hong Kong. But when you look at obviously the expense of running an office at 8 Exchange Square, which I know the Honourable Gentleman, Learned Gentleman, is familiar with the region as I am, but the very expensive property in Exchange Square in Hong Kong, and also in relation to paying for representatives to conduct the marketing strategy in Hong Kong. And I think it's right to ask this question, that when you're looking at marketing and you're spending money, what are we getting out of it? I understand it takes time to build up relationships with businessmen in other regions, and also it takes time for senior partners of firms as opposed to go out there and build connections and network properly. But is there any indication from the discussions he's having with senior partners with respect to firms in Gibraltar as to what is coming back to Gibraltar? I hate to use science in context, but what value is coming back into Gibraltar from those efforts that the government is going through in the region? Thank you.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think I answered that in my original question, where I said that the reports I get from the private sector is that real business has been done, and indeed public announcements will be made in the coming quarter of other work that is coming to its future conclusion. Where members refer to costs and expenses, in particular the office in Exchange Square, you clearly haven't been to the office in Exchange Square, of the Gibraltar office, but if you did, you wouldn't be asking me the question that you have, because the office is absolutely clear. And the reason for that is, of course, because of cost.
And we have the option of going to a bigger office outside centre, which is going to be known as the centre of the business community, the city of Hong Kong, if I can call it that, or having a far, far smaller office in a very good address, which is close by to everybody, with meeting rooms that you pay for when you use them. So our office in Hong Kong doesn't even have a meeting room. It's got an office with two desks, which is tiny, and which then has the ability to use meeting rooms of whatever size you want, as and when you want them. So it's actually extremely cost-effective for that precise purpose. So we opted for a good address in a smaller office, nothing fresh, very basic, literally two desks inside the door, sharing coffee facilities, sharing toilet facilities, and sharing meeting rooms. Service stuff is very common in Hong Kong, London, and everywhere else. So we're very conscious of the cost, of course we are, and that's why we made that choice. But with the private sector coming in, there are plans for things in terms coming to Gibraltar, and that's why they continue to go, and that's why in April next month, almost next month, we will have the biggest trade mission ever going to Asia from Gibraltar.
I quite understand that there is a dual purpose, and both of them are linked to the Hong Kong office. One, at one level, is to facilitate links between professionals of this jurisdiction and then businesses and professionals in Hong Kong. Another aim is to obviously attract in with investment into Gibraltar, and that may be in with investment that takes the form of, for example, a fund that is established with Hong Kong investors here in Gibraltar, entirely through the private sector, in relation to which the government has very little involvement other than having facilitated that contract through the Hong Kong office. But of course, there is a different level, and that is direct investment from Hong Kong in Gibraltar via, for example, contact with government ministers. And I know that the Honourable, the Father of the House, has been in China, busily trying to attract investment into Gibraltar, for which I commend him. But in relation to that aspect, investment that has come directly into Gibraltar, for which he must have obviously knowledge, can he point to any investment into Gibraltar that has been facilitated by the Hong Kong office that he can provide information to the public?
Well, remember, right, the Hong Kong office is simply not focused on financial services. There are a whole series of introductions which have been made by Jason Cruz of the Hong Kong office to other businesses and other potential investments that are being discussed at this very moment in time. So it's not simply working on financial services issues, it's dealing across the entire board and spectrum of investments in the world, which could take many different forms. And I'm not going to prejudge announcements that may be made in the near future, but I can certainly say that directly as a result of the Hong Kong office, since it was set up in Hong Kong, direct introductions have been made which will lead to investments being made in Gibraltar which are not limited to financial services.
I understand that. But presumably the answer is that the Honourable the Minister for Financial Services can't point to a direct investment in Gibraltar from businesses or businessmen or capital in Hong Kong that is attributable to the Hong Kong office. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Speaker, it's not that I can't, it's that I won't.
Just one further question. He's obviously not going to answer my question in that regard, but in relation to Jason Hughes, who is the gentleman that runs this particular office and is paid £250,000 in total, including private education of his children, etc. Is this gentleman working exclusively for the government of Gibraltar in discharge of his functions as representative for Gibraltar in the Hong Kong office? Or is he allowed to do other kinds of business and pursue, for example, the previous trade which was as an estate agent?
Let me make my position clear, Mr. Speaker. I am allowing that question because the Honourable Minister introduced this gentleman into his answer. Okay? And he runs the office.
but I'm not going to allow a debate on his terms and conditions of service under the guise of this question. Mr. Speaker, I'm one of the many, many people who's extremely proud that as a Bulgarian man in a place as a fire in Hong Kong has been able to succeed to the extent that Jason has in his specialized field, which is actually property and property investment. I wouldn't call him an estate agent, and I assume the term was intended to be derogatory, unfortunately. I'm also not going to confirm the quantum, because I don't want anything for me to be involved in. What I can say is that I am delighted with the work of Jason Cruz. The people from the private sector who accompany on my many visits to Asia are also delighted with the work of Jason Cruz, because he's not just in Hong Kong, but when he went to Singapore, he was very much involved in setting up and assisting us in setting up and meeting people, and eventually put up there, all in the best name of the Delta PLC, and for that I'm eternally grateful. As to whether he works exclusively for the Gibraltar Representative Office, the answer is yes.
Speaker, the Honourable Minister of Finance first referred to work in the region of some other jurisdictions that would be well worthy. I did notice somewhere, I can't locate it now, about an intention by the government to work in areas of India, Mumbai and Bangalore and look at different regions within there. What progress has the government made in relation to working in that particular region, given the reference to my question on the board of the Southern the open region? Yeah, what I said in relation to my question is attributed to the work in the government and region. I know that the minister referred specifically also to work being conducted in Singapore, who referenced Singapore and also looked at other jurisdictions' work, particularly in Mumbai, for example, and Delhi. Can the minister confirm whether it's the government's intention to also work within that jurisdiction as well? I believe there was some reference by the election campaign to that region as well in terms of it.
Yes, we are pursuing the possibility of looking at India as a separate jurisdiction, a separate representative, separate representation there. We're in the process of a if I can call it, a public India team being driven by the Chief Minister, which we are a public China party, looking at how we can best utilize the connections and the resources that we currently have to see what better way we can work in India. In terms of the Asian region, obviously, Jason's responsible for the region, from China, Singapore, Hong Kong, and you know, from all of these countries, and potentially more.
Question?
Question
number
200,
the Honourable Alan Kenton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister of Financial Services please confirm that he will make available to all members of Parliament hard copies of the full audited financial statement of Gibraltar International Bank Limited, including the auditor's report, as soon as these are completed for the years ended 31st December 2014 and 15.
I answer the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, I'll answer this question together with question 201.
Question number 201, the Honourable DACP.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please say how many mortgages that the Gibraltar International Bank has granted in the new affordable housing scheme recently completed or about to be completed?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Government.
Mr. Speaker, the full audited financial statements of the bank will be filed at the company's register and available for public inspection in accordance with the provisions of the Companies Act. It will therefore not be just to the auditor, for the whole community to see. The government does not have the information requested in respect of auditors and will therefore not be able to provide this to the House. This information will, however, also be a matter of public record at the Land Titles Registry, as every mortgage granted by a credit institution requires to pay stamp duty and subsequently be registered at the public registry.
Mr. Speaker, I was hoping the Honourable Member would have the service to this House agreed to provide us with copies of those financial statements, while telling us that our Companies Act is over 15 pounds, or about 30 pounds for a copy of them. The rule in any case, I imagine by law, be required to be made available publicly by the bank in due course. I don't see why he cannot make them available to the bank.
Mr. Mr. Speaker, if the Honourable Member is suggesting that they shouldn't have to pay the fee that the members of the public have to pay, I don't see why not. But once they're public, surely they're public.
Mr. Speaker, I find that particularly unhelpful response. I guess we shall have to walk to the bank afterwards and obtain a copy when they're going to be public. Do you have any idea when they're due to be fined?
Because, as I've already said in my answer, the council is filed in accordance with the requirements of the company act, in other words, in accordance with the terms of legislation.
Mr. Speaker, I was asking when the audited financial statements are due to be completed, so do you have any idea?
Mr. Speaker, when we announced in December of 2013 the setting up of the Gibraltar International Bank, I was delighted to see that the members of it welcomed the announcement. But at the time that they welcomed the announcement, they also had caution, full caution, because they were very concerned about the bank being independent and government being at arm's length and not being picking and choosing. Because from this side of the house, it seems that if we are serious about independence, then we should stand back. But then we get criticized for not selling information that we don't have. And if we do get involved in interfering, then we're interfering. So we've done exactly what we said we do, what we promised we do, which is have an executive team which is independent of government, an independent board of directors, and the executive team and the board of directors are running the bank. So do I know when the statements were signed or when they will be signed? The answer is no. I will happily receive the documentation as and when they're required to do, which I have absolutely no doubt and every confidence that they will provide the information whenever it's due.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member officers is obviously fully aware that the government is 100% shareholder of the said bank and entitled to receive that information. Not no doubt the forthcoming AGM, as nearly after the number of services that are making available to us as well, is not willing to do so fair enough. Look, I think that we need to think of 4 years ahead of us. We've got 4 years ahead of us. I will, not from my office, from my own personal bank account, I will write the check for the first time, I will go down to Company House, and I will stop running the affairs of Gibraltar in order to deliver to the Honourable Gentleman at GSC headquarters at College Lane, even if it is an hour out of my time, a copy of the account, because obviously we don't expect to have to do with every other member of the public to do, but yeah, I'm very happy to go down there so that he has the courtesy of the delivery to him, because obviously, you know, the fact that he has £39,000 to turn up in Parliament twice a month is not enough, and he doesn't want to go down to Company House, doesn't want to obtain it, he doesn't want to write, he doesn't say, I will do it for him, Mr. Speaker. But until now, the rule has been that if the document is public, the government does not provide it in this house. And the government, as a shareholder of this institution, Mr. Speaker, is maintaining the strict attitude of independence we have set out, which we were required to do by the real GSC, the GSC that used to sit in this house before the last general election, but which the Honourable Members of the Senate seem to have a different view from.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the pay rise that you've been giving me, because I understood I've been paid £35,000 a year, but hello, I said the other £4,000, and maybe I'll have a problem for £30,000. But, Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to labour the point. I will go to the bank myself and get them. But thank you very much for the effort. Mr. Speaker, no problem. But given that he is speaking for an almost 10% pay rise, I now understand why he may have put a motion down on the order paper and why he was so keen to work out what it was that he was going to be paid. When I was first elected to Parliament, I wasn't looking at what the remuneration was going to be. It was just to serve the public.
Mr. Speaker, I think that in terms of order, that's a particularly out of order compared to the London question.
I don't accept that there was a point of order, but the government has at least just pocket a pay rise because I seem to have said one figure instead of another. So, you know, points of order, the Honourable Gentleman needs to understand are points that have to come within the rules of what points of order are or are not. But look, I can understand why he's embarrassed himself and why he wanted to find a correct sentence on it.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member opposite obviously enjoys playing games with words. I don't. I predict numbers. And he also made a mistake, because I know he's not good at numbers.
Mr. Speaker,
could we bring these exchanges
to approach these because they have nothing seriously to do with the question, except case of petty exchanges in the overall concept. And let us responsible people, let's get on with the business of having three.
All that Mr. Clinton was saying was that the Chief Minister has been reiterating 39,000 a few times already, and we actually got paid 34,995. He was not discussing a pay rise or suggesting that we deserve or want anything else. He's merely correcting the Honourable Chief Minister on a figure that was erroneous.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Honourable Lady's translation of what Mr. Clinton meant. I will look to her to translate what it is that the person who's not good with words is trying to say if he continues to express himself in a manner that is not as he might wish to be, but more numeric.
Please call the next question.
Mr. Speaker, I haven't been waiting for my supplementary my question.
Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman has said that in relation to my question, I remind him of my question and remind listeners, and that is how many mortgages the Gibraltar International Bank has been granted in the new affordable, has granted in the new affordable housing scheme. And it must be hundreds, I mean, I don't know. He was answered and he said, well, the Honourable Gentleman can effectively go to Land Property Services and do a search of mortgages and then he'll get a figure. I don't believe that that is a reasonable answer, bearing in mind that this is a national bank. It's an impossibility for me to go and do a search of all those documents in order to come to a figure. And I just wonder whether the Honourable Gentleman can be more helpful. If he doesn't have the figure, then I can come back in a month's time or in 2 months' time. But certainly it is important that we have this figure because we do want to monitor, and it is in the public interest that the opposition monitor, how many mortgages have been granted by the Gibraltar International Bank in the new affordable housing scheme. And, you know, there is concern about availability of mortgages in Gibraltar generally, and that's the why I've asked the question. Not intended to cut the government out in any way, but it's genuine information that we're seeking in relation to this. Mr. Speaker, I understand all of that, and which is why I said in my answer, the government does not have the information requested. So it's not that I'm telling you, go and do a search of every book, of every single register that I'm type of register. What I'm saying to the Minister, to the Honourable Member, is we do not have that information available. Why don't we have the information available? Because it's absolutely right and proper that we shouldn't. Because we're standing at arm's length from a bank that is operating in a regulated environment. You will have the site of its full financial statements, all of his reports, director's report, that will all be made public, and consequently, I don't know how many mortgages, nor should I know, I don't believe, how many mortgages the bank has given. I don't believe I should. No. I'm sorry, but I disagree with the Honourable Gentleman. This is a, we have a question, we have a question of disagreement. The view is taken by the Leader of the Opposition that because mortgages are made available for affordable housing, which all members support that policy of affordable housing, and the government takes the view that they are dealing with the Gibraltar Bank, even though they are 100% shareholders, is at arm's length. I don't think that those two views can be reconciled, and because I believe that, I am not going to allow a debate at this juncture on that issue. The matter can be debated, obviously, when another opportunity arises over the substantive motion. The Honourable Member so is, but I'm not going to allow the debate to try to reconcile the Leader of the Opposition to try to convince the government that he's right, or the government to try to convince the Leader of the Opposition that they are right. That I will not allow.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful to Mr. Speaker in relation to that. But I'd like to ask this. Doesn't the Honourable Minister for Financial Services recommend that there is a distinction and a fundamental distinction between interference in the management decision of a bank, albeit state-owned, which nobody in this House wants to see, at all, and a situation where the Minister for Financial Services asks the bank not for the identity of any mortgagee or anything of the sort, but a purely statistical information as to how many mortgages have been granted
by the bank in relation to affordable homes. And no doubt, bearing in mind that this is an issue that is very much in the mind of the community, particularly homeowners, because of the lack of what has happened in the banking sector, in the contraction in the banking sector, and the availability of mortgages, and mortgages in affordable rates, that is something that the minister or somebody on the government side would have wanted to have that information available in terms of monitoring the situation. I have to say that I would have expected, for example, the father of the house to have been monitoring something like that, because these are the kind of important, I would say, statistical information that a government minister would want to know in order to monitor how effective the granting of the mortgages and whether there is a difference between demand and supply in relation to it. That's the distinction, and I just want the Honourable Gentleman to recognise that there is a distinction, that we don't want to interfere in management decisions. It's just the statistical information that we believe is relevant and important in the discharge of everybody's duty to the community.
Mr. Speaker, we're not at question time in particular going to be drawn into what is in effect a debate into the degree of independence that the bank should or should not have. Because we do believe, Mr. Speaker, that is the sort of level of granular detail as to the day-to-day business of the bank, which if we were to become involved in, would in effect mean that we were looking at how many mortgages have been granted this week, how many have been granted the next week. And one of the issues that we were very clear on is that this had to be an independent entity. But the Honourable Gentleman is talking about numbers of mortgages. Numbers of mortgages is actually quite relevant because banks intend to report on amounts invested in mortgages, and that's how their capital ratios and the concentration limits that they are concerned with in terms of their regulation relates to the affordable housing scheme or their mortgage book generally. We're not going to be giving this information. We consider that we should not be in any event questioned on it because there's a very simple rule, Mr. Speaker. We do not have the information. The other members cannot require to go out and get information from an entity that is not a department. This is not information that is with our control or power. As a shareholder, Mr. Speaker, we could potentially require that information. We could potentially require information. But our attitude is to say that we have respected the bank's independence, and very much the same attitude as we've taken as to the university's independence, and the bank will report like all banks report, and the bank will report publicly like all banks report. Mr. Speaker, nobody asked the Prime Minister at Westminster whether he can please say how many mortgages have been granted by RBS when the UK government is the 80% shareholder of RBS.
I ask a few things for myself in order to be clear. The simple system then, let us say during the budget session, will during the budget session, will the Chief Minister say, for instance, he himself or the Minister of Financial Services, will they be raising the matter of the activity of the bank in respect of mortgages and other investments which make a contribution to the economy? Because this is the bank. Is a national bank. It's going to play an important role in the economy. Are these factors that will be the subject of debate during the budget session?
Mr. Speaker, the answer is that the only aspect of the operation of the bank which is relevant from the point of view of the government is what we as shareholders perceive from the bank. So, for example, if the bank pays a dividend, then the shareholders and by and say, I've received the dividend of 10 million from the bank because it comes into the consolidated fund, right? But Mr. Speaker, we're not reinventing the wheel. The position of Tip Telecom is exactly the same. So Tip Telecom files an annual report which they make public, they put it on their website. They talk about the number of lines that they have, the number of mobiles that operators or concepts that they have, etc. And the government comes here and says, look, as a shareholder, this year, Tip Telecom has paid me so much in dividends, and they have reported to the shareholder X or Y. In the case of Tip Telecom, the government has directors appointed to the board, Mr. Speaker, who are ministers. I am the chairman of Tip Telecom at the moment, and we have seen reports from ministers in respect of that activity. Here, Mr. Speaker,
we are not on the board. We have a shareholder's representative, Mr. Speaker, but we are not on the board because we wanted to preserve the independence. This is an issue of wide agreement across the floor of the House. The board appointed to be the board of directors of the Gibraltar Independent Bank, I think, met also with support and was welcomed by members of it. It was a totally independent board. But Mr. Speaker, Conservative Leader was on that board, you know, it was not somebody who has an affinity with the parties represented on this side of the House. It was a totally independent board.
Mr. Speaker, nobody is disputing the desirability of keeping the bank independent at all. Now, it is our recollection on this side of the House that the government has in the past, and we'll look at it and we'll come back next time round, that the government has made statements about the percentages of mortgages in the affordable home. Remember that it's the government-owned bank in a government sector. That's what we're talking about. That's why the analogy that the Honourable Gentleman gives is a first one. But they have given a percentage in the past of mortgages that were intended to be granted or have been granted by the Gibraltar International Bank in the affordable home. Now, can the Honourable, the Minister for Financial Services, recall that, or the Chief Minister? Because if that is the position, then of course, all I'm doing here is asking for a translation of a percentage into actual figures.
Mr. Speaker, no, I don't believe the government has given specific details. What they may have been reference to is what each of the banks, and this is certainly come up in meetings with the Gibraltar Banking Association, are able to do in consistently with their concentration risk. So that's a totally different question to the one being asked in terms of how many to the International Bank granted, because what a bank can and can't do in terms of lending is entirely within its own domain, so within the concentration is you can change by putting in the capital. So if one is movable and flexible, it's not a red line, then probably one will understand better than I will on the thinking.
Question number 202, the Honourable E. J. Hayley.
Mr. Speaker, can government provide details of any servicing yard and related facilities provided at the small boat marina?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, a servicing yard and related facilities will be provided in the vicinity of the Mid Harbour Small Boat Marina, adjacent to the Royal Gibraltar Yacht Club. Yes, Mr. Speaker, I find in the Honourable Minister to give me the location, but can you provide any details of what facilities, perhaps the examples, would be provided? This would essentially be a hub for the service in my place. It would be for the association, which has been established under the rules, and which will be running the marina, and they will be essentially running the servicing yard in conjunction with the marina. So all we're doing is making available a piece of land. Just a piece of land that will be run by the committee and so on. Because we're using what technically is land pertaining to the government, the terms for the use of land and so on would be subject to approval, for example, by capital report and so on, because the danger is the committee could become a free-for-all, who would monitor the control and the correct use of facilities, which at the end of the day are publicly owned, despite the birth hold that paying is very free, but at the end of the yard, it does remain from property. Yes, Mr. Speaker, the land will certainly be club property, and although arrangements haven't been finalized, I would expect. To the office of the Deputy Chief Minister who's involved in land matters and OPS. What there will be a license agreement in terms of the grant of the use of the land for specific purposes. And the purposes will be the use as a part of servicing yard for the purposes of the small boat marina.
I think it is a figure that the minister is trying to bring his focus. We believe this is a figure, and even now I'm conscious of you keep on nicely reminding us of the world and just my feeling forward. I think it would be prudent and better, more suitable for both sides. If I write to the Intellectual Sanitary Committee and so on, such as what I was referred to in previous answers, and if I sort of feel I can, or I require such information, perhaps if you leave, I can come back, you know, in this one, feel it just to accept information, and the Honourable the Deputy Minister might be able then to be in a position to shed some light. Because at the moment, all I'm going to get is hypothetical examples, and if you're all in agreement, I'll leave it like that in the future. I'm totally happy with that approach, but to the extent that the importance of the question is simply, will there be a hard for service in the Yard for the Smoke of Marina? Then there is no hypothetical issue about it. The government has identified it in the piece of land, and there will be that hard which will be made available for the purpose of Smoke of Marina. Yeah, I think that you know, the original regular question was I wanted the details, and therefore the details were already have a second, and that's why I used that terminology.
Question number 203, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, the Minister for Justice confirmed the total number of convictions for one, unlawful transportation of tobacco in commercial quantity, two, knowingly concerning the exportation of commercial quantity from Gibraltar without authority or an export permit. Three, consuming cigarettes within a motor vehicle. Four, possessing a cigarette in a commercial quantity without a license since December 2011.
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Education and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 204 to 209.
Question number 204, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the Minister for Justice confirm the total number of cigarettes confiscated and the value of the same for each year as from December 2011?
Question number 205, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Justice confirm the total number of fines imposed by the court each year since December 2011 in respect to the following offences? A. Unlawful transportation of tobacco in a commercial quantity. B. Knowingly concerning the exportation of a commercial quantity from Gibraltar without authority or an export permit. C. Concealing cigarettes within a motor vehicle. D. Possession of cigarettes in a commercial quantity without a license.
Question number 206, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the Minister for Justice confirm the breakdown of individuals by reference to nationality prosecuted for offences in respect to the following? Unlawful transportation of tobacco in a commercial quantity, knowingly concerning exportation of a commercial quantity from Gibraltar without authority or an export permit. C. Concealing cigarettes within a motor vehicle. D. Possession of cigarettes in a commercial quantity without a license each year since December 2011.
Question number 207, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the Minister for Justice confirm the numbers of arrests for tobacco offences which have not proceeded to prosecution?
Question number 208, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the Minister for Justice confirm what resources are available to the Royal Gibraltar Police and HM customers to reduce the illicit trade in tobacco smuggling?
Question number 209, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the Minister for Justice confirm what measures the government are considering in the fight against illicit tobacco smuggling?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Speaker, this administration has implemented various bold and groundbreaking measures to tackle the illicit trade of tobacco and to eradicate any antisocial behaviour which surrounds this objective. These include new legislation and other measures which serve to list various measures. One, reduce the retail sale of cigarettes from 1,000 to 200 cigarettes to the same individual at any one time, providing additional power to the collector of customs to suspend wholesale and retail licenses where the holder of a wholesale retail license or the servant or agent of the license holder has been charged with an offence contrary to the Tobacco Act 1997. Place an obligation on the collector of customs to withhold consent to a change of director or shareholder of a company holding a license under the Tobacco Act if that company or any of its servants or agents have been charged with an offence under the Tobacco Act.
maximum amount of cigarettes that a person can have in their possession to 200 in the area immediately before the land border with Spain and Gibraltar International Airport. Create a zone which serves to restrict the sale, possession, and transportation of cigarettes in prescribed areas around Gibraltar. In these areas, RGP and or customs officers are empowered to make inquiries and carry out non-systematic checks which allow any person or vehicle to be stopped and searched on a random basis and without the requirement for there to be reasonable grounds for believing that an offence has been or is being committed. This is a new direction in the public interest to discourage the issue of any new retail and wholesale tobacco licenses unless an existing retail tobacco license is surrendered, terminated, or otherwise rendered permanently inactive. Applying this condition to licenses which permit only a maximum of 300,000 cigarettes in a retail outlet at any one time, and for cigarettes to be sold only between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., except for large supermarkets and petrol stations. Relocate tobacco retailers in Gloucester and Laguna State to other areas with only vending machines being authorized in these estates, a measure which has been very well received by the residents of those states who have seen illicit tobacco activity and its related antisocial behavior blight their peaceful enjoyment of their homes. Expand Four Corner Station with a creation of two additional search lanes and a purpose-built covered vehicle search facility. Six outgoing barriers were also installed to carry out non-systematic outgoing checks and electronic gates erected in the underpass to the commercial gate, which are closed during the silent hour. Installed CCTV cameras and green and automatic number plate recognition cameras in the area of Four Corners, and the employment of 50 more customs officers, which provide the collector with more human resources to deal with smuggling of any commodity. Speaker, the government has already implemented these very considerable measures and continues to invest heavily and significantly in resourcing our law enforcement agencies. The Royal Gibraltar Police now has 238 officers and Hope and Customs 166 officers that are also equipped with new and very substantial land and marine assets. The deployment of these resources in the fight against the illicit trade of tobacco and any antisocial behavior that surrounds this activity are operational decisions for the Commissioner of Police and the Collector of Customs to consider. The statistical information requested by the Honourable Member is set out in the schedule that I now hand over to him, and if I may say so, Mr. Speaker, reflects the excellent work done by the law enforcement agencies in dealing with the illicit trade in tobacco. In particular, since we have enhanced the legal tools they have at their disposal by amending and tightening Gibraltar's world-leading legislation for the curtailment of illicit tobacco activity.
I thank the Minister for Justice for his answer and the circle which I want to come back to. But insofar as my question 209 is concerned, and I'm grateful that he set out the measures that have been implemented to curb and combat this trade, but I also asked for, in relation to what measures the government are considering in the fight. Outside the ones that he has set out, what is the government currently considering in relation to the resources currently at its disposal to fight this threat?
Peter, the question which says simply confirm what measures the government are considering in the fight against the illicit tobacco smuggling. I mean, just look at on its own might suggest that nothing has been done, and what are you actually doing, or what are you going to do about it? And that's why we felt it was necessary to promise, not just this, but every other question which relates to statistical information, with all the very considerable measures that have been taken. We now consider, having taken all these decisions, this is the direction, and after the special zones, relocated some premises, some licenses from premises from a state to other areas, that a very significant headway has been made as required by this government to tackle this activity. We have also enforced, as I have explained, adequately and significantly, the Royal Gibraltar Police and Haitian Customs, who have land, marine assets, and a significant number of personnel in order to deal with this and other criminal activity. Having done all that,
government is clearly always on the lookout and always aware that there may be additional measures that may be required. And these are matters that are continually reviewed and discussed with the Royal Judicial Police and with Customs. To the extent that additional measures may be appropriate or may be worth considering, then that is something that we're going to do. But certainly, for the moment, we have gone a very, very long way in tackling this activity. And as I have indicated in my answer, the results of the statistics that I have handed over to the Honourable Member reflect the success that the government has had in dealing with this issue, in putting all these measures in place, in properly equipping our law enforcement agencies, and the excellent work that the law enforcement agencies are delivering by actually delivering the results that are evident in those statistics, with a number of arrests, prosecutions, and confiscations for the evidence in those statistics.
I'm grateful for the answer delivered by Mr. Professor in relation to that. I have to take it from that answer that currently, as it stands, there is no thought by the government to introduce new measures that they believe that the current measures, the measures that they have implemented, are satisfactory.
Mr. Speaker, it's not a question of whether particular measures are satisfactory. This is not a process that comes to an end on any particular day, and we say, well, that's the end of the process. As I indicated, this is a matter that is continually being reviewed and assessed. We have taken all these measures already, and we do continue with discussions with the relevant law enforcement agencies. And as and when new measures are considered appropriate, they will be announced and certainly implemented. But we will certainly not hold back should any additional measures be required and be advised of us if they should be implemented.
Mr. Speaker, just one further question in relation to the volume of tobacco on our streets, as it were. I don't like to use inflammatory language, but it clearly are significant numbers of cigarettes on our streets, over 3 million per year, in terms of confiscation, and in terms of the confiscation amount that you've kindly given me. Wouldn't you say that should give our community significant cause for concern? Mr. Speaker, no, sir. For this reason, Mr. Speaker, the quantities of tobacco which are sold in Gibraltar are often the subject of derogatory statements made against Gibraltar by instruments of the Spanish government and by members of the Spanish press. In fact, the amount of tobacco sold in Gibraltar, which includes that amount of tobacco, is an amount which successive governments of Gibraltar have defended with the European Commission. In fact, also with OLAF, with the British government, and also in the press with the Spanish government. So we do not believe that there is a problem, because if honourable members care to look back at what I have said and been questioned on a number of occasions, in particular in relation to the number of cartons of tobacco sold in Gibraltar, which at 12 million this year, or the year before, was lower than at the time than before we were in office, if I can just put it that way. I'm going closer now to 9 million. That is exactly the sort of amount that is assessed as being the right amount by the European Commission for sale in a place like Gibraltar, given the number of visitors that there are in Gibraltar during the course of the year, which amount sometimes in the region of 12 million visitors. So, Mr. Speaker, as we and previous administrations have said repeatedly, in the defense of the legitimate tobacco trade there is in Gibraltar, the controls that we put in place to deal with the illicit trade in tobacco are the ones that we are advised are appropriate. They are now tougher than they ever have been, and the amount of tobacco being sold in Gibraltar, we continue to believe, as the former administration believed, of a much higher figure, is in keeping with the legitimate trade that can be done in a community such as ours with 12 million visitors a year. I would be very surprised if members of the group and I are taking a different line.
Question number 210, the Honourable E. James Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Justice confirm whether the government intends to introduce the duty lifter scheme?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Speaker, yes, sir.
Speaker, any idea when this could happen?
For for the Speaker, that it will still be up to us if it would have been in place already. The Honourable Member will recall that there is provision in the Criminal Proceeding Evidence Act for the provision of legal representation, particularly when somebody is arrested, which is what the GPCC primarily deals with. And that is, as I recall, the only provision that hasn't been implemented yet. We did create a scheme and announce the scheme and invite all lawyers to be part of the scheme. We were simply not able to implement the scheme because only two lawyers put their names on the list at the time. At the time, I understand that Mr. Phillips was not one of the lawyers that put his name on the list for that particular scheme. But it was simply a physical impossibility with two lawyers willing to carry out the work to have a GP for a certain scheme. At the time that we were in discussions with the Bar Council in relation to the reform of legal aid, in which there was a separate question as a rate for legal aid, it was felt that we would retake those discussions in relation to the GP process of the scheme once the new legal aid scheme was put into place. That is now in place. The new rules have been established, so this is a matter which is now on the card in terms of discussions with our council. Not necessarily because of mutual blessing, but certainly we would want the Bar Council to encourage all members, because it's a voluntary matter, to encourage all members to put their names, or as many as possible, to put their names on the list so that we can implement the scheme. So if the question originally was, does the government intend to do this? Yes, the government has tried to do this. It has not been able to do so. We are hopeful that with the encouragement of the Bar Council, more barristers and solicitors will put their names on the list. We're ready to implement. We've got all the administrative measures in place and were in place previously. We're ready to implement at any time as soon as a sufficient number of lawyers agree to go on the list to make the scheme effective. Otherwise, if we don't have people on the list, there is nobody to call as you see to visit them. So we are very happy to implement this as soon as we possibly can.
Thank you for the answer. Will the Minister for Justice know whether that his department will be going out to the profession in terms of Bar Council speaking members of the Bar to join the scheme? Is it that I'm not familiar with any recent request from the government to the profession asking whether there is an improved level of interest in relation to the scheme?
Speaker, as it happens, I have a meeting planned with the chairman or the president of the Bar Council. I believe it was next week, although it may be in a couple of weeks' time, certainly imminently. And this is one of the items that I propose to raise with you.
Yes, Mr. Cooper, the issue really here is the remuneration to criminal lawyers. Criminal lawyers at the end of the day, and lawyers are a business, it's a profession. And of course, the rates that were being paid to criminal lawyers under the previous rules was not sufficiently attractive in order to allow people or incentivize people to basically sign up for the scheme. Now, the rules were changed, I believe it was last year or 2014, exactly, 2014. Can the Honourable Gentleman explain why it's actually taken so long from 2010? Well, my calculation roughly about a year and a half from when the Honourable Minister for Justice changed the rules to make the remuneration more attractive for now in order to take this up with the Bar Council and with the profession.
I think it's something that we have taken up with the Bar Council on a number of occasions, in particular before the scheme or the attempt to introduce the scheme was made. I understand it was just before the new rules were published. There is a difference between the rules for legal aid, which are the rules that are paid when somebody goes to court, when somebody is appointed to take a deed or a preparation for court work, and the implications of appeal. They are different rates, and the rules that were published are not rules rates which relates to the duty services scheme. The duty services scheme has separate rates. The rate that we sought to implement at the time, which was even before we reformed legal aid, were the rates from recollection. They were the rates that we took from the UK duty services scheme. And from recollection, we chose the London rates, which were higher. But that's just from recollection. There was a duty services scheme in the UK, which has, as I recall, two sets of rates, one in London and one outside London. My recollection is that we chose the London rate, and those are the rates that would be implemented, subject to whatever adjustments have been made in to those rates in the UK. So they were linked in a way to the new rule, because one of the suggestions was that whatever the rate might be, if you attend somebody as duty services, and then that person is on legal aid, then the rate that will be paid on legal aid may determine whether you go on the list in the first place, even though those are not the rates of the duty services scheme. But we now have the rates which were agreed with the Bar Council, and we do have the rates set out as implemented in the UK, so we see no reason why this is not going live at any of the time, as soon as possible.
Thank you for the answer. Just one further question on this. Is there a way in which the government can consider as the Minister for Justice and where he's set up as Minister for Education that we could encourage those students undertaking the certificate in particular and remind them of their duties in so far as this is concerned? And as we all know, many of us who are lawyers in this chamber have done free work, have worked on legal aid and legal assistance on legal assistance matters. Is there a way that we can encourage those students? I know about free work, but is there any way that we can encourage our students in terms of their education level to remind them that that's part of our duty as lawyers to conduct that type of work for our community? I just a pipe in relation to that and would welcome any thoughts that the Minister may have in relation to it.
Well, we would certainly want to welcome as many lawyers as possible to be part of the scheme, and I do very much hope that the member himself will put his name down for the list. Whether it's possible for those undertaking the certificate in civil law to actually do it, I don't believe it's possible at the moment, because if honourable members will recall, the new training requirements which were set out last year included the academic course in civil law, included a professional skills course which was undertaken at the end of the training year, and a practical year of training. And if we only want those three elements are completed, that the prospective lawyer is then be able to apply to be enrolled and to be called to the bar in Gibraltar. So those that are doing that course are currently solicitors of ours in training, having done their degree, having done their professional qualification in the UK, and now doing the local training requirement, which is set out in the people tax. And in those circumstances, they don't have rights of audience, they can assist. I'm not sure that it would be right for them to be the ones that become the duty solicitors.
So, a point of clarity, I'm not suggesting that a student should conduct during the course of his training, a student should conduct the work of an advocate in court, but only one, they should be reminded that as lawyers they should be making that contribution, especially given the fact that this community helps them to achieve that good education by sending guys in the first place in the United Kingdom and solicitors. I would have thought that a message to them as part of the criminal part of the course that's being an officer, that they could be reminded of those obligations and the moral obligations.
Mr. Speaker, we're certainly happy to remind them and encourage all those lawyers, all those trainees to sign up for the scheme, that once they become enrolled in the civil bar and are able to practice as a lawyer. And I think that there is also a role of heads of chambers and firms, because those heads of chambers or the management committee ought to be reminding, particularly young lawyers, because you know when you are breaking into when you're first starting out as a lawyer and
you are doing work that is civil, that is also criminal, you're doing work in the magistrate's court, perhaps not the kind of work that Mr. Phillips, who is nearly 20 years old, might be doing at this present moment in time, but certainly we've all done it, we've all been there, we've all done work in the magistrate's court. And at that time, when you are a young lawyer, this is precisely the kind of work that you also should be doing, and it enhances your experience as a young advocate and a young lawyer to be precisely doing this kind of work. I mean, duty solicitor work often then leads to legal representation in the magistrate's court. Indeed, it may also lead to legal representation in the Supreme Court. But we've all got to, as a legal profession, make sure that not only are our new barristers, our new solicitors, and I think more new barristers, because we're new solicitors, we've now got these articles, these training schemes within Gibraltar. But I understand the Honourable the Minister for Justice intends to look into the creation of pupilage as well for barristers here in Gibraltar. But in the context of reforming and also ensuring that barristers are properly trained, I think that encouraging and for Chambers to take a lead in encouraging our young barristers and our young lawyers to participate in these schemes is very worthwhile indeed, not only for them in terms of the experience, but also for the community generally in service to the community.
Speaker, I'm not sure where the Honourable Member gets the impression that I intended Mr. Justice to introduce further changes in the form of pupilage that he has mentioned. This is not something that has been discussed with the Bar Council. We discussed the new training requirements for barristers and solicitors during the course of last year and implemented those provisions by way of amendments to the Supreme Court Act. But certainly, to the extent that as much encouragement can be given to younger lawyers, although there will be cases which will be apt for more senior lawyers. And like him, I certainly recall being called at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning on numerous occasions to attend to clients in the police station, and therefore subsequent representation in the magistrate and the Supreme Court. But I, the Honourable Member mentions head for Chambers and management, and we have two partners across from the other side of different firms, and I would ask them also to encourage their firms to not to call their lawyers to be part of the scheme, but certainly to encourage as many lawyers in those two firms that they have between them a very significant number of the lawyers we have in Gibraltar, for as many of them to be part of the scheme so that it is as successful as it can be.
Yes, I'll discuss it with him and the Chief Minister, and Mr. Phillips will discuss it with Mr. Albert Isola.
We're going to have one last question. It's the last one on justice. One question left on justice, and then we begin the debate in the afternoon.
No, Mr. Chief, unfortunately, the diary requires that I adjourn now, and I suppose that we should return on Wednesday at 10 a.m. Wednesday at 10 a.m. 10 a.m. To finish the question, but then deal with the situation for the minister.
I now propose, therefore, the question of the House to now adjourn to next Wednesday at 10 a.m. And I'll put the question, which is for this House to now adjourn to next Wednesday at 10 a.m. On the other hand, the House will now adjourn to next Wednesday at 10 a.m.